Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly's. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
All right, back for another installment of It's My House. And today we're continuing from yesterday. Our guest, Sherrick, I call him Sherrick Official. That's his social media name. Today's podcast is titled Generating Income Off the Grid with Sherrick. Now, yesterday, let me give you the backstory on Sherrick. And his mic will be open briefly. Here's a man that was on Section 8, and he was earning $4 an hour, had a wife, plus four kids. And he came across some information. We connected on one specific video, which I play that audio here quite often. Lamar Alexander. Anyway, he followed that information plus another video that you can get on YouTube, Back to Eating Gardening. I might have messed that name up, but it's there. Long story short, he went from the $4. Now, there's a transition period. I'll let him go through that. But he went from the $4 an hour job and the Section 8 to now he owns at least 2 acres of land. Might own one, but at least 2 acres of land. So he went over how he got that yesterday. And and he learned how to grow his own food, and he's kind of innovative with that. So he's eliminated to a high degree his food bill. He doesn't have to go to Whole Foods because he grows his Whole Foods, including, you know, animals. What else? How he got affordable living and debt-free living without a mortgage. So that's in, we have that archive, so you can go back to yesterday's podcast and check that out. But he's here again live. So if you have any questions that might be on your mind, ask him that. Now today we're gonna take off from generating income off grid, because he's self-employed. So he's in Oklahoma, one of my favorite states. And he doesn't have a 9-to-5, but he makes his income, I call it off the grid income, but he doesn't go into a 9-to-5. So we're gonna ask him today how he does that, and if you have any questions, 619-768-2945. Once again, make sure you have something to take notes with, be it on your phone, laptop, desktop, whatever. I guarantee you're going to take some notes. So anyway, let's go to Oklahoma. Good morning, Sheriff.
Good morning.
Great to have you back. Well, let's start with first thing, for people that missed yesterday, just give a quick overview of how you got the 2 acres and how you got the debt-free home on your 2 acres.
Okay. So I worked at Will Rogers Airport in Oklahoma City. I was a sky cap and a VA. That means I was the one that would be out on the curbside in the winter and in the summer, outdoors, checking baggage, whether it was snowing, raining, or 115 degrees. And I would be the ones that would load your bags onto the plane. I would also be the ones whenever someone that was disabled with a wheelchair or that was just injured. Sometimes it was elderly people. Sometimes it was overweight people. Sometimes it was Thunder basketball players that had some kind of ankle injury or something. I would push them from point A to point B. I would get them from check-in with their baggage to their gate, and even onto the plane if they were disabled enough that they needed assistance with that. And then a flight attendant would take it from there once I got them loaded onto the plane. And so I only made $4 an hour. Technically, we were supposed to report that we made tips, but really almost never did, unless it was like Christmas or something like that, or certain specific seasons. But other than that, we really didn't make tips because we were not allowed to tell people that we worked for tips. And the job that we did in other states, which your passengers that you're dealing with are going from one state to another, well, in other states, the same company that we worked for would pay them a different wage and not let them take tips. So these people would be coming from one state where they are familiar with this company not getting tips into our state where we're making $4 an hour and not getting tips, and we were not allowed to tell them that we worked for tips. So we almost never got them, not because of any fault of the passengers, just because our company wouldn't allow us to advertise that we work for tips here. And so our customers simply didn't know. They thought we worked for the airlines specifically, and people that work for the airlines were making $25, $30 an hour. So they're not going to tip you if they don't think you work for tips, and they think you work for $30 an hour, obviously. And you're not allowed to tell them, and they don't know. So I had to figure out some way. I was working full-time, and I was also going to school for personal training and nutritional counseling. And I already knew quite a significant amount about nutrition because I'd worked for years at a health food. It was formerly called the Oklahoma City Health Food Center. Now I think it's called Green Acres Market. But I worked there, and at that job, my job was to assist people in – it was a vitamin and organic plant-based and free-range grocery store and vitamin store. So my job there was to teach people proper nutrition, what foods to buy, how to prepare them, because a lot of people that would come in that store didn't know anything about how to make a healthy meal. They were coming from, you know, eating a standard American diet and, you know, frozen lasagna and a hamburger from McDonald's, microwave stuff. So I'd have to tell them what to even do with something like kale or Swiss chard or bok choy or broccoli, you know, they didn't even know what to do with it. And part of my job while I worked there, there was a bookstore there, health and wellness bookstore, that sold the nutritional books of all the most famous authors in America on their different ideas on what is healthy and what isn't. And they would come through there and give seminars, and they would give 2-hour lectures on why their book was the best book, what their dietary theory was, what research and evidence it was based on. So I basically got educated by all of the different and various people, the inventors of all of the diets. And these weren't like the fad diet type of diets that are unhealthy. These were like serious diets, like whole food plant-based diet or the paleo diet, things like that. And I would get to hear, you know, completely different and opposing theories on what is healthy to eat and why. And then people that made vitamins for the different vitamin companies that we represented would come in there and tell why their vitamins were the best. So I got to sit there and hear the research and hear the evidence of why one was correct over another. And I got to go study it and see what was more valid and more true. So before I even got into personal training and nutritional counseling school, I already knew more than any of my teachers did. I just wanted to get certified so that I could, you know, have a piece of paper saying that I knew what I already knew. In fact, I often taught my teachers things that they did not know about extreme calisthenics and about whole food plant-based diet and high raw plant-based diets and organic grass-fed free-range meat versus non-organic meat that my teachers didn't even know. So because of that, though, the reason I tell that story is that background gave me a extremely rigid conscience on feeling bad about feeding my wife and children unhealthy foods, because I knew well more about what I was feeding them than the average person. So I couldn't in good conscience do it. I was literally losing sleep over what I was feeding them. Even though it was just what normal people would call regular food in the standard American diet, I knew exactly what was in it chemically and what was added to it and what was carcinogenic about it and which foods caused more cancer and which foods caused more diabetes and which foods caused more heart disease. And I literally couldn't do anything about it because I couldn't afford to. And so we tried to go to Whole Foods and like Sunflower Market and Sprouts farmers markets, the organic farmers markets started taking food stamps, we started trying to go there. But it was just all way too expensive to where it would go through our whole month's supply of food budget, and you know, we would only be able to buy a couple of days worth for what we were supposed to buy the whole month worth. So I realized very quickly my only option was to feed them unhealthy or figure out a different way that didn't cost money to feed them healthy. So I decided to grow food, but I knew absolutely nothing about growing food. I knew everything about the nutritional value of every healthy whole food plant-based food or every free-range grass-fed meat or dairy or egg product. I just didn't know how to produce it myself. And from everything that I could tell from any common knowledge video on YouTube or anything about how to do it, it always involves tractors and tillers and industrial chemicals and pesticides and herbicides and lots of land. Like they would say things like just to produce enough food for one family of just a couple people like mine. My family was me, my wife, and my 4 children. They would say that you would need, you know, at least 20, 30 acres to produce enough food for that, because they're talking about on an industrial monoculture food system where you're growing a whole 5 acres of wheat and a whole 5 acres of corn and whole 5 acres of rice and things like that. Whereas I started to learn that there's something instead of monoculture called polyculture and organic polyculture and permaculture, where you can grow multiple plants in the same small space mixed together, and they don't have to be in perfect, pretty straight rows. They can be, but they don't have to be. But they can, they don't have to be tons and tons of rows of the same thing. You can have one row of, you know, broccoli, one row of kale, one row of lettuce, you know, one row of cabbage. And I started learning things like Three Sisters gardening that the Native Americans used to do, where instead of, like, for instance, if you're growing cucumbers or tomatoes, instead of putting them on a trellis and having to buy the trellis, you can grow something that's tall and sturdy like corn, and then grow something like squash or zucchini on the ground around it as a mulch, as a living green mulch. And then you could plant the like cucumbers and tomatoes and the vining type of plants or even grapes or whatever to where they would grow up the corn and the corn would act as the trellis. Or I would start growing like grapes along the base of fruit trees and then the tree itself would act as a trellis. So if it was like a peach tree, then when peaches weren't in season, normally your peach tree is just absolutely worthless until peaches are in season. Whereas when you start using the tree itself as a trellis, now when the peaches aren't growing on the tree, now you got grapes growing on the tree. Now you got tomatoes growing on the tree, little cherry tomatoes and things like that. So I started learning stuff like that, but I still had the problem of the tilling and the fertilizing. And I just didn't want – the whole point of why I wanted to learn to grow food was to have stuff like they had at Whole Foods, organic, non-chemically sprayed, non-GMO things. So I kept doing research. I'm just a tunnel vision person, and I'm the kind of person that just does not accept no for an answer. When I get an idea in my head, I won't listen to people that tell me that it can't be done. I will simply not stop searching until I find somebody that not only says it can be done, but that has done it. And then I will find as many people that have done it in as many different ways as possible and sometimes try to hybridize them and improve upon them if need be. So I found Paul Gauchy, the Back to Eden film person that you were referring to earlier. I found his documentary. He's a wonderful man. He's very friendly. You can get his phone number on YouTube, and he gives it out in a lot of the videos, and he will literally answer you. He's like world famous now from this documentary, and he will literally answer your phone calls and answer all your questions, or you can write him letters. He's put his address on there, and he gives tours. I've never been there because he lives in Flint, Washington, and I live in Oklahoma, but he gives tours of his property now every, I think, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and his garden is so productive. His garden is only like, I think it's like 30 foot by 40 foot or something like that. It's not, I mean, that's large to somebody that only has a front backyard, but for somebody with a lot of land like I have or like he has, that's not very big at all. And he grows so much food so effectively. He never waters it, never. He never, ever waters it. He doesn't drip irrigate it, nothing. He does not water it at all. It is watered only by the rain that the wood chips hold in as a sponge-like mulch. And his garden is so productive with no watering, no weeding, no pesticides, no herbicides, that he can literally have a tour every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, each tour lasting several hours and having 200, 300, 400 people going through his only like 30-foot by 40-foot garden, and he lets them take samples of his food and eat it, and his food grows back so quickly and is so productive that he can literally have 600-ish people a weekend. What is that, like 2,400 people a month or so, give or take a few, eating out of his garden in mass amounts, and it does not even stop his garden from producing enough for him, his wife. I think he has 6 children, and he still has to give away excess to all of his neighbors and his friends and family and in churches in the area, and he gives it away to poor people that you know would otherwise need to be on like Section 8 and food stamps and stuff. He gives them so much food they don't even need to be on food stamps anymore, just out of his little garden, because of the way that he grows food is so productive. And he could sell it even if he wanted to. That would be one source of homesteading off-grid income if you wanted, is you could literally just set up a farmer's market on your land or an unattended farm stand. A lot of people do. He doesn't do that because he's just a really kind-hearted, like, philanthropist type of person, and he just wants to give everything away to people. He's a very Christian, good guy. But there's nothing wrong with selling it, too, if you want to, and a lot of people do that. A lot of people will just set up tables on their own land, start advertising in the small town that they bought their land on, and a lot of these small towns only have, like my small town, for instance, only has, like, one Walmart, and it's supposedly like a super center, but it doesn't even have in it what a basic grocery store Walmart would have in it, let alone what a super center Walmart has in it. Like, it's supposed to have groceries in it, but it literally just has canned food and some bags of chips and stuff like that. There's no produce, there's no meat. There's another grocery store here that does have those things, but it's very expensive and it's not even organic stuff. But since it's a small town, you know, they can charge like Whole Food prices, and it's not even organic stuff. It's just regular stuff.
Now, let me ask you this. Before you got your 2 acres and you went off-grid, were you living in a larger city on the grid, like Oklahoma City?
Yes, I was. I was living in Oklahoma City. First, I lived on the east side of Oklahoma City, which anybody that – for anybody in your audience that's not from Oklahoma, that's the hood here. That is the absolute hood. I lived on 1000 Northeast 20th and Kelly. That's like what real estate investors here call that is a war zone. It's like a no-go zone. Like, they blackball it to where only very few investors will even buy or sell or flip or rehab properties there because it's so dangerous and it's so non-profitable. It's not even worth the trouble, really. And I lived there. And then I slowly, you know, working at the airport and stuff and just doing anything I could do extra to make money, anything I could do legal to make money.
Right.
I had to work my way. Me and my wife worked our way out of there together. And we moved to when we lived on 1000 Northeast 20th and Kelly, we were not on Section 8 yet. We were on Housing Authority, which is similar
okay.
but different. It's not as good. It's not as it's not as much benefits to it, and it's a lot more work involved to keep having it. So we were on Housing Authority, and we were on a wait list for Section 8. We filled out the paperwork or whatever. We were on that wait list for years. And so while we were doing that, I was just saving up money, working. She was working hard, saving up money, and we were just trying to better ourselves because we didn't want to stay on Section 8 and food stamps and all of that permanently. A lot of people will want to stay on that forever because that's the system is designed to do that.
Yeah, well, some people, they make it into a lifestyle.
Yeah, they do. And to be fair to them, they almost make it to where you almost have to, honestly, because every time we made any benefit in life, anytime I got any kind of better job or small raise, like when I was on Housing Authority, I worked at the health center and I made even less money than I made at the airport. And then when I got the job at the airport, they considered that a huge raise, the $4 an hour, and they significantly lowered our food stamps and they significantly affected our Housing Authority. It gets to the point to where you're like, you can almost psychologically just, you want to be like, why am I doing more work and working harder for less when I can just quit and do that. So I can really, honest to God, see why they do that. It's almost like it's set up for you to do that psychologically. It's like they're using game theory on you to make you want to stay on it. And I think they are, because dependent people don't get an opinion. If you're dependent on the government and the government tells you to jump, you have to say how high. Like, they literally tell you every single way of every single aspect of how you get to live your life when you're on Housing Authority or Section 8 or food stamps. And I'm grateful that I was on it. I don't even agree with the socialist way that stuff works or is even funded, and I did not like to be on it. And I felt really, really horrible as a human being even being on it, because it's completely against my worldview. I'm a libertarian, and I don't even believe in taxation, and that is how those things are funded. So I only did it, and my wife also only did it because we were parents, and we had no other choice but that or our children starve while we tried to work our way out of poverty. And
right.
So, but I can understand why people stay on that. There are people that would stay on it anyway, just because they're bad people. But a lot of those people that are staying on it, they're literally just being psychologically wargamed. Like, it's human nature that if you're like trying to better yourself, you need to see a reward for that. And when you get a raise or you get a better job, that in and of itself, in a normal scenario, is a reward. But imagine if you're not on Section 8 and you're not on food stamps, you're just a regular person, and you get a raise, and say your rent is $800 a month, and you get a 50-cent an hour raise, and you're like, okay, that, you know, that'll help me pay my rent a little bit more. But then your landlord said, oh, you got a 50-cent raise? Well, we're going to change your rent from $800 a month to $1,200 a month. Now you didn't get a raise. Now you're making less. It's like you got a demotion, but you're doing all the extra work that comes along with getting a raise and getting a harder job with none of the reward. So it's very psychologically traumatic to even try to better yourself when you're in that system. And I think they do that on purpose, because, like I said, dependent people are they'll vote how you tell them to vote, and they'll believe what you tell them to believe because they don't have a choice. And they'll kick their husband out of the house and put him on child support if you tell them to, and they'll do whatever you tell them to do to keep their benefits just to survive. And so,
right.
But we weren't like that, and we were trying very hard to get off of that. And so we got out of the – when we lived on 1000 Northeast 20th and Kelly, we we hassled the Section 8 caseworkers all the time. And just like when you apply for a job, you got to hassle them and hassle them and hassle them if it's a really, really good job. And sometimes it might take years before you get hired. And then eventually you'll wear them down and they'll be like, well, these people really want this job. I'll give them the job. You have to do that with Section 8 too. I don't know how it is now, but that's how we had to do it. So we were on the wait list for years and we finally got it. And so we could have picked – when you're on Section 8, I don't know how it is in every state, but in Oklahoma, you can pick wherever you want to live as long as the landlord accepts Section 8 already, or as long as they're willing to fill out the paperwork to go through the process to be able to accept Section 8, because they got to agree to certain things and stuff with the government. So you can either pick from the list that they give you of here's all of the houses on this side of town and this side of town and this side of town with Section 8, or you can go just randomly ask landlords, hey, in a better neighborhood, because the neighborhoods that already take it tend to be bad neighborhoods. Hey, would you take this if it's a guaranteed this many dollars a month in rent for you that you don't have to worry about, you know, not getting paid because it's the government paying it? So we chose that option because we looked at all of the houses that were already accepting it, and it was just a different – it's the same stuff, different place. You know, it wasn't really no different than where we were already at, just a different ghetto hood that, you know, now the gangsters in our neighborhood aren't familiar with us and might want to kill us instead of, you know, being – somewhat friendly-ish towards us. So what we did is what we always do, and we went and haggled and negotiated and talked people up. And we would dress really nice and, you know, put on dress clothes. And because a lot of these landlords in nicer neighborhoods will say no simply because they expect that you're going to be some thug or some, you know, white trash or some, you know, some hood thug or just whatever your race's stereotypical version of a you know, a crap person is. You know, they think you're going
to
be the kind of person.
Section 8, and my mother took Section 8 on a couple of properties that she had in another state. You got some good ones, and then you got some ones with problems.
Yeah, you do. But people in like Edmond or Moore or Norman don't assume that. They just assume if you even say the word Section 8, no, you're a problem. So you have to really convince them. And we also had a problem going in against us because before we were on housing authority, we had gotten evicted because of the jobs that I had. I couldn't afford to pay rent 1 month, and we got evicted. And then we got lucky. We were effectively homeless for a while, and my wife and my young – before my other two children were born, my youngest three children had to go move in with my wife's parents in Lawton for a while until we got us on a housing authority, and then they moved back. And I just kept working, and I was like living in a vehicle and working and trying to save up money.
You need to write a book. Yeah, I worked with several years ago when I was getting started. I only met him worked with him for one night. Was on a security job. His name was Paul. I don't even know if I remember his last name. But Paul was divorced. He had, when he was married, he had a wife and four children. And I never, and you know, we were earning about $5 an hour on that job. That was like a second job for me. But he said if you got four kids, now he was living in Northern Virginia right outside of Washington, D.C. He said if you got four kids, you need at least $1,000 a week. I never get him saying that. So, you know, that's a lot
it's
of kids.
True.
I mean, that's a lot of miles to feed.
I mean, you can – obviously you can live on less than that because I did, but it's not good. You know, it's not – you have to go without eating sometimes for your children to eat, and you have to feed them – even at that, you have to feed them subpar, very unhealthy – just non-food. I would call them not foods at all. You know, I don't consider the stuff that I had to feed them food. Most people would, because most people don't know the things I know about nutrition.
Most people don't know what food is.
I mean, ramen noodles, for instance, is not food. It's got no nutritional value, and it's mostly made out of sodium. And I'm not talking about like sea salt or pink salt. I'm talking about chemical white bleached sodium. It's very, very unhealthy to survive off of ramen noodles, and that was a lot of our frickin' meals were like ramen noodles or like hamburger helper without even the frickin' hamburger a lot of the time. And that's not healthy. That you can survive off of that, but you can survive off of eating hot Cheetos only three times a day. You know, that doesn't mean it's good for you. That just means that you can survive it. And that's what we were doing. We were, they were, you know, me and I would have to not eat sometimes sometimes my wife would have to not eat. If it had to be a choice, it would be me. Sometimes it had to be both of us. Sometimes we both went without eating. Sometimes I went without eating. The kids never went without eating, but they were eating crap. They didn't know it because they didn't know any better, but they were eating crap. And it was especially problematic because before I worked at the airport, I worked at the health food center. And at the health food center I worked at, like many grocery stores, they wasted a lot of food because they would get new shipments in of new food, and they would throw away the old food when there was really nothing wrong with it. Other than sometimes nothing was wrong with it at all, or sometimes, you know, a can would have a dent in it, or sometimes a milk or a meat would expire like that day, and there was literally nothing wrong with it other than it just simply said it was expired, but the milk was not actually bad. The meat was actually frozen in an ice cube block, so there's nothing wrong with it. Things don't actually expire when they're frozen. It's just the law. You have to get rid of it or whatever. If you're especially at a health food center, they want everything to look as fresh and just healthy as possible. So if they've got a new shipment of kale or Swiss chard or bok choy or lettuce coming in that's not got any wilt on it at all and it's perfectly crisp, and then they've got some that's just a little bit saggy and just a little bit wilted, you know, it's perfectly edible, they will throw it away. And so I would just ask them, hey, can I have this? And I would take grocery carts full of stuff out of there. So the problem was we were eating healthy organic stuff because of me doing that. And then I got the job at the airport when I lost that job. And so I could only eat what I could actually buy. And it was only like ramen noodles and stuff. So when you go from a really healthy diet to a really, really unhealthy diet, it's very shocking to your system. So, you know, that was not good for my children and wasn't good for my wife, wasn't good for me, you know. And so I was trying to figure out a way to solve that problem. And I would go to, you know, any health food stores that were as similar to the one I worked at as possible, trying to find if there were any with any decent prices at all. And there just really weren't. I mean, there's absurdly expensive. Like we could, for the size family I have, we would only be able to afford to buy a couple days worth of food with what was effectively our month's grocery budget. And, you know, and we didn't know that until we just tried to experiment. You know, we tried to see, well, what if we would try crazy stuff. Like what if we only bought potatoes, but we bought organic potatoes, and we bought a bunch of potatoes, and we buy a bunch of rice, and then just buy enough leafy greens and enough vegetables just to top off the rice and the potatoes.
Did you ever try the dumpster diving method of food?
I did that, and that's essentially when you say that to people, a lot of people think that sounds gross or something. That's why I wasn't even going to bring it up. But it's really – basically what you're doing is what I did when I worked at the health food grocery store, except you're doing it outside. Like you can literally cut them off when they're taking stuff out when you learn their schedule and just be like, hey, can I have that? And
some exactly. Of them I got two friends of mine. Like I say, the term dumpster diving turns a lot of people off, but you're not actually going in a dumpster.
Out.
Like you just said – these two knew the schedule, so they would get stuff. They had relationships with people.
Yeah, that's what I do. That's what I would do a lot of times. And even when you do get it out of the dumpster, it just depends on where you're going, because there are some people, when they hear the word dumpster, they think gross trash, maggots, flies, rats. That's not how a health food store dumpster typically.
Yeah.
Usually, a health food center's Whole Foods just destroys their food waste. They literally put it in a thing so that you can't do that. They destroy it, and they make it impossible to salvage in any way. But most health food stores, they have when you say put it in a dumpster, it's basically if it's wintertime, they're just putting it in a very clean deep freezer. It's just a clean metal box that they neatly stack stuff in a lot of time because they know that people are coming and doing that, because a lot of the employees, like I did when I worked at that health food center, when there was too much that I couldn't take it home, I felt bad throwing away. So I would neatly put it in there and place it, and I would tie things off, and there was to where there was no way anything was going to get on it or to it. And in the winter, so that's what most people that are working at these stores do, because they feel bad about what they're doing. They're forced to by their bosses. And their bosses are forced to by the law, because you can't sell people stuff after it claims to be expired, or that if a person could claim a stomach ache and sue you when there's really nothing wrong with them and win millions of dollars. So there's reasons why they do that. I don't necessarily blame them. I blame the government, like I do with most things, because, of course, no small business is going to risk getting sued when the government makes it to where they can be sued for giving away free food.
Well,
so,
sure, now, let's switch gears here a little bit, because for people that want, like I said, he goes in detail. If you get our podcast from yesterday, which is free and archived, he goes through how he got the 2 acres and some mm-hmm. and growing stuff and animals. Let's go to generating an income off the grid, because how do you do that?
So there are lots of ways you can do that. You can grow food, and to start off growing food, watch the Back to Eden film with Paul Galchi. And then, like I said, every weekend he has a tour. He has YouTube videos that people all over YouTube film those tours and post them on their channels. Just type in Paul Galchi Back to Eden Garden Tour after you watch the actual documentary. And what you can do is, speaking of dumpster diving, when you're dumpster diving for fruits and vegetables, unlike with meat, you can actually turn that into more food, because if you dumpster dive, sometimes you'll get a thousand cucumbers, and you're not going to eat 1,000 cucumbers. You can eat the 20 or 30 cucumbers you're going to eat, and then you can chop the other 950. You can chop them into slices, and the seeds are right there. You can put them under the wood chips, and then they'll sprout a couple of – each slice will have like 4 seeds in it or 5 seeds in it, and it'll sprout 5 cucumber plants. So you can do that with tomatoes. You can do that with zucchini. So point being, you can start growing your own food with the Back to Eden method and seeds that you get for free from organic grocery store waste, and you can start selling the excess of that if you want to. You can sell it to your neighbor, because even when you live in the country, like I live in the literal middle of nowhere, and my closest – when I first moved here, my closest neighbors were, 10 and – 20 acres away. Now people have bought some land around me, and now I've got neighbors within like 3 acres of me on both sides, and then none on the other 2 sides of me for hundreds of miles. But I've got enough neighbors up and down the street that if I wanted to, I could sell organic free-range eggs to them, because they have to go into the town 10, 15 minutes away. And it's not far, but we have to drive into the town to get anything if you're wanting to get some groceries from the grocery store. So, I mean, if I wanted to, I could throw out a bandit sign, just like with real estate investing, throw in a yellow sign with black letters or a white sign with blue letters with, a Sharpie Magnum and say eggs for sale, produce for sale, meat for sale, dairy for sale, organic food for sale, cheap or whatever. And people would pull in here and knock on my door all day long and buy stuff from me if I wanted to. I don't do that because I'm a private person and I just want to be left alone for the most part, except when I leave my house to socialize and network. But I don't really like people coming to my house bothering me too much unless it was scheduled or something. So I don't do that personally, but you could very easily do that. And you would you could look up Curtis Stone on YouTube.
I interviewed Curtis about 4 years ago. Yeah, good guy.
Oh, did you? Yeah, I
interviewed him only one time, but about 4 years ago.
Yeah, I've never spoke with him audibly like you have, but I've emailed back and forth with him because I was going to do that before I got into real estate when I bought my land, but before it occurred to me to just keep buying land and selling it, I was going to do that. So I bought Curtis Stone's book and course about urban farming and market gardening, and then I bought John Martin Fortier's Market Farmer book on how to grow hundreds of thousands, $350,000 worth of profits, worth of food on 2 acres, or on 1 acre actually, and I own 2 acres. So basically, if I would have used the system, I could hypothetically make like $500,000 on my 2 acres. I bought Connor Crickmore's course on how to make about $500,000 on 2 acres, $500,000-$600,000 he claims on 2 acres. So if I wanted to do all of that, I could. I just found an easier way that's just I could do that if I wanted to, and I recommend it to anybody that wants to live off grid and doesn't want to do real estate, because some people, different people have different personalities. Some people would hate real estate, even the easiest, best parts of it, and then they might love market farming and market gardening. Whereas I love health food, and I love fitness, and I love getting people healthy, and I loved working at an organic grocery store selling that stuff. But I don't think I would really too much like or love growing it to sell to people. I would just have been doing it for the money, and I found an easier way. But some people would love to do that and would hate real estate, and that would be a good way to go for them, is to sell produce and dairy and free-range meats from your land, from your small plot of land. You can get mini cattle, dwarf cattle. They don't get any bigger than goats, and they produce hundreds of pounds of meat, and they eat much less grass, so that you can have dozens of them on a small acre or two. You can get goats and sheep and chickens and turkeys and emu and all kinds of different things. And they will eat your, they will basically, they'll weed whack and brush hog and mow your lawn and turn that grass and that weeds into meat and milk and eggs and cheese that you can sell to people. Especially if, I'm an advocate of a whole food plant-based diet, and I think it's the healthiest way to eat, but not everybody's going to, no matter what advice you give people, not everybody's going to eat that way, period. So you can grow vegetables for yourself and then use these animals to keep your land mowed and stuff, and you can sell the meat and the dairy and the eggs to people because you're not even going to eat it. It's kind of like a straight narrow version of what drug dealers say, you know, don't get high on your own supply. Like if you're a,
right.
a whole food plant-based eater, you're not eating meat anyway at all. Some whole food plant-based eaters are that way because of ethics, and they would think it was immoral to do that, to sell meat. I'm not in it for ethics. I'm in it for health. So I would totally sell other people meat if they want to. I would advise them to eat more plants, but they're going to do what they're going to do anyway, so they might as well eat a healthier meat that I can give them than some factory farm meat that's not organic and that, you know, is filled with vaccines and chemicals and stuff and testosterone. So I would definitely
sure,
before, good conscience sell
before
that.
You get into the – the real estate part, we got somebody with their hand up. 407, your mic is open.
I'm at the register now. Okay, I have a question. I'm doing some composting. I bought a compost bin, and I'm mixing it up, and it's turning dark. Like, what's the next step for me as far as preparing the soil?
What kind of composting are you doing?
I have kitchen scraps and yard waste. I do like leaves and all anything that's in the yard that's old and dirty and or just decaying. And then I do all my kitchen scraps, apple cores, avocado skins, all of that. All the kitchen scraps go in there. So I've got a combination right now, garden waste or yard waste and kitchen scraps.
Okay. So there's lots of ways to compost. There's thermophilic composting, hot composting, cold composting. I think what for me is the easiest is once you – if you watch that Back to Eden garden documentary that I referenced earlier, once you lay down your wood chip chipped branches and leaves compost and let it compost into soil, which it'll do very quickly because it's a hot compost, it'll compost quickly, you can literally put your food scraps in that. And it will compost because, like, you can part the wood, the compost, the wood chips and compost that you're growing vegetables in on the side of the rows of your vegetables. You can just part it in a different spot every day, just move along down the edges every day, and you can put your food waste in that, your plant food waste in that, and cover it back up. And the earthworms and the red wrigglers that will naturally occur in your garden will literally eat that. And they will turn that into compost tea directly at the roots of your of the vegetables that you're growing, and you don't have to deal with all of the turning and
animals. What about animals and pests, though? When you do that,
you won't have a problem with that because if you're using composted wood chips, they don't create a smell. You'll have a more of an animal and pest problem doing an above ground composting system like what you're talking about. Know what I'm talking about, because when you're doing an above ground composting system, they can smell it. It's giving off a smell, even if a human can't smell it, of rotting, decaying organic matter, and it will attract soldier flies, which is, I mean, there's nothing wrong with soldier flies. They're composting flies. They're natural, but they're unsightly, and it will attract, if you live in a rural area like I do, it'll attract anything from raccoons to possums to armadillos, skunks, and you can do it, and you can even make your compost bin to where they can't get into it. I've done that before, but it's easier to do what I'm saying because it doesn't create a smell, so therefore it doesn't attract any animals because you're literally putting it under soil, so there is no smell being given off, and the only thing that can smell it are the earthworms under the soil because they are designed to be attracted to that. They can sense where it's at. But above ground animals and scavengers won't smell it, so they won't bother it. Flies won't bother it. Nothing will get to it once you've put it under your compost. So you can literally just take a rake and pull back a section of your garden compost that you're growing food in along the edges of your vegetables that are growing, and you can just dump it in there and cover it, and it will disappear. I mean, you can literally go back there the next day or two, and it's gone. And also another thing you can do that Paul Gauchy, the Back to Eden Garden guy, also does this is, he has one spot where he has wood chips thick on the ground and that he fenced around specifically for his chickens.
and he leaves chickens there, and he will throw a lot of his food waste in there. And you could also use goats if you wanted to, or even mini goats or sheep. But you can fence in some kind of herbivore animal there in one spot on top of wood chips, and they will eat all of the food waste that you're talking about, and they will turn it into compost immediately because a goat, especially goats, goats' poop is automatically usable. It's not a hot fertilizer. It's a cold fertilizer. So you could literally feed your vegetable food waste to a goat, and it will poop it out the other end the same day. And when you they're like giant pellets, black pellets. And if you were to take a stick and crush that, it's just green powder inside of there. So it's basically just nitrogen powder. It's perfect for your garden. It's perfect for your wood chips. It's perfect fertilizer, and it's not a hot fertilizer. And they instantly turned it into compost for you. So
okay. You
can compost
okay.
it.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not in a rural area. I'm kind of in an semi-urban area. I mean, it's somewhat set apart, but I don't have goats and all that. No animals, but we have cats. But my compost bin is definitely covered. It actually I can roll it around. It's like a tumbler. So,
okay, compost tumbler. I
put it in there and close it up and then and move the tumbler, and it's mixing it all up. I got lots of worms. Every time I look in there, the worms are, like, amazing.
Yeah, compost tumblers work great, and they don't really have a problem with attracting problematic animals so much. So because they're high off the ground, and because they're hot compost, and
right.
Yeah, those are good composters.
Use the wood chips. You say I should still use the wood chips with that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you should get a tree company, like a landscaping company in your area, like whenever. You see a city truck that, you know, with the drivers cutting down tree branches along the side of the road and then wood chipping them through a wood chipper and throwing it in the back of their truck. They have to go find somewhere to pay to dispose of that at. You can tell them, hey, bring that whole dump truck and dump that in my front yard. And they'll, if you're close by to where they're at, they will do it, and they'll thank you for it. And all you have to do is spread that. You can spread it. It depends on if you have newspaper or cardboard to put down first, then you only need to spread it like 8 inches deep. If you don't have newspaper or cardboard to put down first, you need to spread it about a foot deep. That way it won't.
This is so informative. I've been enjoying all the information you're sharing. So thank you. Keep up the good work.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, Shug, let's switch gears to real estate.
Okay, so real estate I got involved in after I moved to the south side of Oklahoma City into the Section 8 house. I got involved in real estate for the same reason I got involved in farming and homesteading, because I simply wanted to be able – I was trying to see which way I could get to work first at being able to make enough healthy food for my family. So I was trying to go the one route by growing it myself, and I was trying to go the other route by making money enough with real estate to be able to just afford it. And so I went ahead and started buying as many courses as I could find on virtual wholesaling, on co-wholesaling, on rehabbing, on just any kind of real estate you could think of, that the low-hanging fruit kind of real estate, you know, things that you can get into without already being rich, obviously. So I started out wholesaling houses. And that worked, but it didn't work for me in Oklahoma as much as I liked. So then I started learning about virtual wholesaling and nationwide wholesaling and stuff. And I did some of that. And it also, again, it worked, but it didn't work as well for me as it did for other people that I know. So I eventually settled on mobile homes. And mobile homes I really liked doing. As far as monetarily, I liked doing them. I didn't enjoy actually the process, but they made me the most money for the least effort up until that point of everything I had tried. So I would buy a mobile home for $2,000 that was worth, you know, mobile homes are harder than houses to like really comp and stuff. You have to go off of what an apartment of the same size in the same area would go for if it's a livable, nice mobile home. But, you know, there might be one 3-bed, 2-bath mobile home that's a worthless piece of crap and another one that's really, really beautiful. So it just depends. But if it's a decent or nice one, you can get one that's worth, you know, that you could sell all cash for $20,000, and you can get it for $2,000 if you're a good haggler, and I am. So I bought multiple mobile homes for anywhere between $1,500 to $3,000. I was using other people's money to do it because I didn't have the funds to do it. So I convinced people to do it, and I paid them back what I borrowed from each of them plus a lot of interest. Not that they made me. I always, like, I would have an agreed upon amount I'd give them back, and then I'd give them back more than that because I just appreciated their help because they didn't have to do that, you know. So I would buy mobile homes for $2,000-ish and sell them for my first one I flipped. I think I bought it for $1,500 and I sold it for $17,800 in about a month and a half or 2 months or so. Wasn't easy to say. I had to work hard at selling it. I mean, I had to put it on Facebook Marketplace and boost the ads. And it was more so not easy to sell because of social media platforms screwing with me than actually the real estate itself being hard, because Facebook likes to mess with me because I post things they don't like politically or religiously or whatever, ideologically. And every time I post something on my personal page that they don't like and they flag me or put me in jail for 30 days, they will hit my business account too. And I don't know why. Sure. My business account isn't even made in my name. It's made in my partner's name, but they somehow figured out and linked them together. And like clockwork, anytime I get flagged on my personal Facebook on either one of my pages, they flag my business page. So it made it very hard to sell. But when it actually would allow me to boost it and marketplace and use marketplace and respond to the replies and stuff, after it started actually working and when I got out of his Facebook jail, I really sold it in like 2 weeks. It took me about 2 months to sell, but in reality, I sold it in like 2 weeks because within 2 weeks of marketplace allowing me to use it, I sold it for $17,800 cash. And then we did a couple more. You can owner finance. You can sell mobile homes through owner finance for residual passive income. You know, right. Make a couple hundred dollars a month off of it for a temporary amount of time, for, you know, maybe a year, maybe 2 years, depending on how you set it up and how much the payment is. Or you can sell it all cash. Just depends on what you want to do, and it depends on what kind of buyers
you
have in your area.
Virtually. As a matter of fact, before we go further, for the people who don't know what virtual wholesaling is or virtual, define that for us.
So usually when people wholesale, tip in the older model, you physically had to be there to do everything. So you're physically going to have to see the house. You're physically going to have to go down to a title company. You're physically going to have to show the house to people. So you're limited to the area that you can do that in, because obviously you're not going to realistically want to travel more than maybe 45 minutes, hour, any direction outside of where you live, especially if you're poor enough that wholesaling is the avenue of real estate you're starting off with, because there are other parts of real estate you can make way more money in, but they cost way more money. So if you don't have enough money that you're trying to do wholesaling, you're probably not going to want to be driving 3 hours every single time you need to go see or sell or buy a house. So with virtual wholesaling, you know, people just, you know, read the 4-hour work week and figured out, hey, you can break this. You don't actually have to go to the title company physically. You don't actually have to be here to sign the contract. You don't actually have to see the house. If you can get somebody to do, the seller can do a video walkthrough and you can tell them, no, you skipped over that part. I didn't get to see the floor there. Zoom in right there so I can see the crack, and if there's a crack there or if there's a problem, you can get them to climb up on the roof and show you. And if they are a desperate enough seller that they're going to let you haggle them down where you need them to be anyway, then they're going to probably do all of that you're asking them. And if they don't, and if you are dealing with a seller that it's a good enough deal, but they won't do that, then you can get another wholesaler in the area. You can contact them and say, hey, I'll give you $500 out of the sale of this deal, or whatever you want to agree to, $1,000, $200. It just depends on you and them and what y'all want to agree to. If you go walk through this house and do a thorough, you know, inspection of it. And once you've made enough money doing that, you can actually just hire an inspector if you want to and say, hey, you're a professional real estate inspector. Go inspect my houses for me in this city or this town. So it severely unlimits your potential, because, like, the reason I had problems with wholesaling is just because the market in Oklahoma in general was saturated with wholesalers, whereas when you're virtual wholesaling, you can go anywhere in the United States. And then I started co-wholesaling, which is where instead of going and finding the house and then finding the buyer and then putting them together, you can just do either or half of that. So you can just go build a buyer's list if you're good at that, and then go find people that are selling, wholesaling the kind of properties your buyers want, and say, hey, I got 10 buyers that any one of them would love that property. Sign this contract that says I get 50% or 40% or 30%, whatever you want to agree to, I always did 50-50 because you're doing 50% of the work. But sometimes there were more problematic wholesalers that just didn't like that idea, and I really didn't care, and I just say, fine, you know, I'll take 30, whatever. And you can just make, you know, if the wholesale assignment fee is $15,000, you can make half of that, or you can make 30% of that or whatever. So it's still thousands of dollars, and all you had to do was build a buyer's list instead of finding the property. Or if you're really good at finding property, whether offline with bandit signs and stuff or whether online virtually with different methods, and you don't like dealing with buyers, you can do the opposite, and you can go get all the houses under contract, and then you can find the wholesalers in the area that have already a buyer's list and say, hey, do you have any buyers that look for any of these types of 10 properties I have here under contract? If you do, I'll give you 50% of the assignment fee if your buyer buys, if you don't try to bypass me and stuff. And then you just make them sign a contract that says they can't circumvent you and go around you and get your property or whatever and things like that. Just different paperwork to protect yourself and everything, like with any kind of real estate. Most people won't try to do that stuff, but some people will. So you just, to be safe, you just want to make it impossible for them to do it with paperwork. So that's what virtual wholesaling is. You can virtual wholesale or co-wholesale virtually. And but yeah, I ended up going to mobile homes. But with mobile homes, I mean, you can do anything virtually, but with mobile homes, I never got into doing it virtually because even though it made me a lot of money easier than wholesaling did, it came with its own unique different kind of problems that I just, from my personality, I didn't like really dealing with. Because when you're dealing with mobile homes in parks, at least, which is what I was doing, you don't have to deal with them in parks. You can deal with mobile homes on land, and that's probably a whole different thing, but I never did that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're dealing with mobile homes in parks, you got to deal with each individual park manager. Sometimes you got to deal with a whole corporation that owns a park that you didn't even know owned it until you start dealing with them and stuff. And so some parks are more friendly to investors. Some parks aren't. Some parks will give you hell, and some parks will help you. They really should all help you if it were being logical, because you're literally buying older mobile homes in a park that's usually filled with a lot of newer mobile homes and nicer ones, and then this one's an eyesore, and you're fixing it up, and you're making it look nicer like the newer ones, and then you're selling it to a good owner that the park has to approve of before you can even sell it anyway. I mean, you can sell it to somebody that the park doesn't approve of, but only if they're going to move it out of the community. So either way, it's a win for the park, because either you're selling it to somebody who's going to take that old eyesore mobile home out of their nice new mobile home park, or you're fixing it up and selling it to somebody that they approve of and then making them money off of a lot rent on a property that didn't have anybody in it for years or months or whatever. So if they were being logical about it, they'd all like it. But some people are just illogical in any type of real estate. Some people just hate wholesalers. Some people just hate, you know, mobile home rehabbers. And some people just hate rehabbers in general. So a lot of the parks will give you some problems, and I just didn't like that part of it. But it was one way that you can make a lot of money with not very much money, because you could literally, you know, take your income tax. If you got $1,500 or something on your taxes, or $2,000, you can go buy a mobile home. And sometimes you don't have to do anything to the mobile home. Sometimes you might have to just get it cleaned out by a professional cleaner. Sometimes you might have to paint a little bit or something in there, or just whatever. You just go through it, and if there's nothing wrong, sell it how it is. If it's just dirty, get it clean. If it's clean but has some problems, then fix them. You just figure all that out before you buy it and budget that into what you're doing. And you can, with your tax check or something, you can buy a mobile home and flip it, make almost $20,000, sometimes more than $20,000 off of something you only spent a couple
now,
thousand.
Let me ask you this. I've never done mobile homes, but I know there's a distinction between real estate and mobile homes. Mobile homes are, I believe, classified as private property, which, because real estate, your de facto partner is the local taxing authority. So with mobile homes, the local government, they don't put a tax assessment on that, if I'm correct. There's no property tax bill that comes attached to that on a yearly basis.
It's not a property tax bill, no. They can tax you for them. But it's not the same, and it's not going to be as much as a house, definitely. And the purchase process is totally different, too, because you're not going to go to a title company at all with mobile homes. You're going to go to a tag agency. Like, it's like buying a car or a motorcycle or an RV, but it's a house. But it's treated – the purchase process is treated like it's a car. So if you've ever bought a car or sold a car, it's just pretty much the same thing, just a little bit different paperwork, but at the same location.
All right. And a lot of people in the mobile homes, including, I guess, tiny houses on wheels or skids.
Yeah, those are pretty cool. They're expensive to make or buy, but they're pretty cool.
Well, a lot of people have... My definition of a tiny house, and there's no official definition of a tiny house, nothing over... Nothing over 399 square feet. Anything over that, like a 400 square foot house, I define it as a small house, not a tiny house.
Yeah.
And then if it's over $25,000, it's also not a tiny house.
But exactly.
That's LA's
definition. Those tumbleweed tiny houses are beautiful and nice, but some of them are like $80,000, and I'm like, are you kidding me?
Well, they're retailing, and they're basically taking advantage of.
It just doesn't make any logical sense.
Right, exactly.
Because the only kind of people, because some people that buy tiny houses at this point now, it's becoming like a fad for like hippie people that, you know, want to, like, I don't know, stop global warming or whatever. So they think that by having a smaller house, they're going to do that. Those people are the ones that have gotten it to where it's going to cost you $80,000 to buy one new. But
right. But
logically speaking, before that was the case, the only people that wouldn't want to buy a house with literally no bedrooms and a loft is somebody that's poor. And so making that option for them is cool. But then once you get it to where it's like $80,000, like, that doesn't even make any logical sense anymore, because they could just buy a regular house with four bedrooms now at that point in some cities and some towns and stuff. But like, or you could do it Lamar's way, where it's basically a tiny house, but the cabin thing, but you just build it yourself, and it's just not as fancy of building materials and stuff. It's not supposed to be as pretty as a tumbleweed tiny house. It's supposed to be more like a manly little rugged cabin thing, and that works. Those are good
well,
things
now,
to do.
Now, because you can do this from your – well, then there's also land flipping. But how do you work? You work from your home now, so I'm guessing you're doing this stuff virtually mostly?
Yeah, I've been working from my home. I've been doing what they're now calling self-quarantining since long before Corona, because I'm a prepper also, and so that's part of why I wanted to homeschool and wanted to work from home. And now I live on my own because my wife separated from me, took the kids. So I live on my own on my 2 acres, and I work from home. And I only ever really leave my land when I'm going to drive 2 hours to Edmond, Oklahoma, to pick up my kids or drop off my kids, or when I have to meet with my business partner because he lives in Bethany. But nothing that I do from my part of the job requires actually leaving my house at all, except for just my business partner likes to meet from time to time because he's just an old fashioned. He's an older white guy, and he just likes to meet face to face and have meetings sometimes and everything, whether it be actually like physically necessary or not. It's just what he likes to do, and I do that because it makes him happy. But there's nothing about it to where if you were doing it yourself, you ever even have to leave home if you didn't want to. With mobile home investing, you have to, it's not something as easily done virtually, and you kind of have to be there and stuff. So who you would want to go to for your audience, who I went to learn that, his name is John Fedro, F-E-D-R-O, John Fedro. Just go to YouTube and type in John Fedro, mobile home investing, and he's got tons of free videos, and he's also got courses and books if you want to buy extra mentorship and stuff. He's a really, really good teacher at mobile homes. He's what we learned everything we knew from mobile home investing from, and it works exactly what he's telling you to do does work. I just ended up finding that for me, land was just so much more hassle free because there's no park managers, there's no mobile home parks, I don't have to go physically see it. But when you're wholesaling a house, you don't have to go physically see it when you're doing it virtually, but things can go wrong that you didn't catch in a video, or that somebody didn't catch, or somebody was lying to you or purposely trying to mislead you, and it's hard for you to tell that virtually. Whereas with land, you can literally look on Google Maps and zoom in on the GPS satellite image and see what it looks like, and it is what it is. It's like what you see is what you get. There's nothing to hide. There's nothing to, once you buy it, now the house burned down. Now somebody, the pipes burst because of the snowstorm at the mobile home park, or there's none of that crap with land. It's just so much easier. It's just so much more stress-free, in my opinion.
So now you virtually do that on – you can do that virtually from your – wherever you are.
Yeah, that's what I do. I've never been to any of the land I've ever bought or sold. Any of the land I've ever bought besides the one I'm living on, I've never even seen in person. And I sold all of them, and they were in other states. They were in states I've never even been to and probably never will be to. So.
Okay. Now, do you escrow those transactions, or how do you do them?
We've done different things. Right now we are shifting how we're doing it because we're starting to work with a professional lender for land, that's what she does for a living. And so when we first started out, we weren't doing that, and we were self-closing, and we were charging doc fees. So that's what I did too.
I bought 10 acres. Well, my first 4 acres, I met with the owners of the land. So I spent about 4 or 5 hours with them, and we closed at their office. It's principal to principal. But on the 10 acres I bought in Texas, because I'm in Florida, I became aware of it on eBay. And basically, did everything through eBay.
I was telling my partner about that. We've never used eBay, and I was telling my partner that you said that you do a lot of land through eBay, and he was wanting to know if he could talk to you about
an easy thing. Now the best stuff is because I've got interest in Oklahoma myself. The best thing, what I recommend to everybody is, well, everybody's got a different situation. When I was on the ground and then saw something that would never be listed or posted online, but I knew the locals, and it was the locals that I knew in this particular town in Oklahoma, they're the ones that hooked me up with the owner who lived in another state, and I was able to get that acreage of property. But yeah, eBay's got quite a bit. It's all over the place. But I recommend people look at towns that have a population of 1,000 people or less, and there's a lot of opportunities. And if you happen to visit some of those places, like I said, once you meet some of the locals that live in that area, it's just acres upon acres that you can pick up on the cheap.
Yeah. So we've never bought any from eBay yet. We might once you talk to us more about how you did that. And we've never bought any from anybody that we knew or from being on the ground, like you said. We've done something in between both of those things. What we do is we send out blind offer letters. So we'll research an area and we'll research how many lots of land at the size we're wanting to buy at the time or in a particular area. And we will send out mass offer letters. We will assess the value, the overall value of the overall properties. And sometimes you'll get that wrong. That's why you're sending out a mass offer letter, because you might be looking at 100 different 2-acre properties, and one might have nothing on it, whereas one might have city water and city electric, and might even have a basement or a tornado shelter under it, and might have a water well on it. Something that increases the value in the eyes of the owner, obviously. So you're going to go off of the lowest common denominator with your offer. You're going to offer as if they're all just raw, rural, vacant land. And so you're going to get some people angry, and so what? You're going to get some letters written back to you with a FU on it, so what? I get, a lot of people, just like with houses or anything else you're doing, if you're making the right offer for an investor, you're going to get angry people sometimes. So I literally will send out a 5,000 mailer, and I might get 4,000 calls of people telling me to go straight to hell and what a worthless piece of crap I am and F my mother and all this other stuff, and I don't care. I mean, that's my job. My job is to be empathetic to the people that call and have real problems and want to talk about them, and they lost their family and they just inherited this land. My job is to be empathetic to them while being calloused enough not to be affected by people that you upset. So you have to have a balance. So I can have one caller 1 second call me and tell me to burn in hell and human diarrhea and
have to not let that affect me, and I don't even have a problem. It doesn't even affect me at all at this point. I've been doing it so long. And then 5 seconds later, I get another call, and I got to answer the phone as if that didn't just happen and be very cheerful and nice. And then it turns out this is a nice person who's calling to thank me for sending them an offer letter because their mother just died or their father just died or their wife or their husband just died, and they owned a piece of land that this person's never even been to, and they've already got to deal with the stress of the funeral, and they can't even figure out how they're going to pay for the funeral. And I just sent them an offer for just the exact right amount to pay for that and get them rid of the property taxes they were stressing about. Or the other day I bought one from a guy who his unfortunately his wife was dying, and so he wanted to sell for the offer that we sent him was just the right amount that he had been praying for his wife to get the surgery. So we purchased the land from him for the amount that he wanted. This was right when we're changing our business model, though, where we're going through a lender now. So that process with this particular lender was new to us, so it was a little bit slower than we were used to. And unfortunately, his wife passed away in that week of time. But, I mean, probably she would have either way because she literally passed away with a week's difference. So I don't know what would have happened, but we'll never know. But either way, we told him, hey, listen, we know that your motivation for selling this property was to save your wife's life. And even though you signed this contract, you know, you do not have to sell this. We will back out of it on our end for you if you want. He's like, no, I don't want to deal with this land. I got, you know, it'll help me pay for her funeral. It'll relieve some stress and some bills off me now that I'm losing her income from whatever income source she had, and things like that. So he still wanted to sell it. And, for the same price, so we went and bought it from him, and he thanked us for it. And so you'll get some people cussing you out and telling you, you know, that you're the devil, you're Lucifer incarnate, and you'll get other people telling you that you're some kind of Messiah angel sent from God for them, and you just got to learn how to take in the compliment of the one and shrug off the other. And not everybody can do that. Some people can't deal with that. I'm not one of those people. I can be nice.
How many acres you plan on accumulating?
I'll buy the whole world if I can, man.
Okay. Now, people that are just tuning in, and we have Sherrick on here today. He was on here yesterday. Now, you got it. And for people that's tuning in, if you don't, you got to know his backstory, which he used to earn $4 an hour. He had a wife and four children. Okay, he was struggling financially, and he got some information that is available online. Matter of fact, the connection between me and him is one video, which I played the audio on this, Solar Cabin, which is on YouTube, which Lamar Alexander talks about how he built a cabin for $2,000. He put in a solar electric system for, let's just round everything up, total of $5,000. Then he doesn't have any mortgage. So Sherrick basically followed that video as well as some other information, you know, on gardening. And he got from underneath all that. So Sherrick, basically you're living a debt-free life. Am I correct?
Well, right now my solar...
As far as
the
mortgage
that,
payment goes...
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I have no rent and no mortgage.
Yeah, no rent payment, no mortgage payment. Now, are you on solar yet or?
No, I had a tornado not too long ago, and it destroyed. That's why I got a new mobile home on my land, because my old one got destroyed, and everything that I had on it was destroyed, so I had to start all over. I'm actually starting my garden over, too, because while I was in the interim before I moved a new mobile home out here, my compost got overgrown with grass. That's one thing that can happen to those kind of gardens, is that just like they're perfect for vegetables, they're perfect for grass or weeds if you let them seed in there. So while I was gone, people's weed seeds from other properties blew in on it and overgrew it. So now I got to take my goats and run them through there and get that eaten down.
But you know,
compost,
even with the tornado, okay, which they don't come through every year, that's still bad, and then you got to, you know, rebuild, but you still got the land. But the thing is I'd rather have that than a 30-year mortgage or a high rent payment. My whole thing is, if you're paying $500 or more a month in rent, you really need to start looking for a place that you can buy. Now, the thing is, you're going to probably more than likely have to look 40, 30, 45 minutes, an hour, maybe 2 hours outside of an urban area for that freedom. But I'll use myself as an example. I'm in Florida. My first 4 acres is in Florida, but it's a 3-hour drive from where I'm at. But the thing is, the property taxes on it is less than $150 a year. That's on 4 acres. I had to fly to Oklahoma into Tulsa, and then 45 minutes away from Tulsa to take advantage of that opportunity there. And then the 10 acres that I have in Texas, I haven't physically laid eyes on it yet, but I just paid taxes on that about a month ago for the year. It was like $38.77, something like that, under 40 bucks, on 10 acres. So I'm looking. Now, I got a house in D.C. The property taxes on that is over $5,000 a year. So I have to use the rural strategy to cancel out the city strategy. Well, city is actually D.C., I consider D.C., New York, any city that's got over 500,000 people to me is basically a plantation. But that's a whole nother podcast that I'm not going to get into today. All right, what we're going to do is take a quick break here, Sherrick, and then come back to the phone line.
Okay.
People keep talking about how the world is going to come to an end. And I wonder, in these days and these times, if anybody people keep talking about how society is falling down today. And as hard as I try not to listen just to what them folks got to say, but you know, I just can't help but look around and see we digging our own grave. And there's just one thing I want to know. Can anybody be saved?
Everybody.
Okay, we're talking about generating income off the grid with Sherrick. And Sherrick, now for people out there, men or women, that want to, I mean, they're struggling. Let's say they're living in, because you were living in Oklahoma City starting off. What are the advantages of moving off the grid? And when I say off the grid, for people listening, I'm talking about you living in a city that's got, let me lower this down to about 100,000 people. A city that's got over 100,000 people. And they're struggling to pay that rent or mortgage payment. They're struggling, you know, they don't know how they're going to eat. What are some of the basic steps that they need to take to get off the grid?
So I bought my 2 acres. I don't actually, like, technically, legally speaking, I live in Lindsay, but I don't actually live in Lindsay. I live outside of the town of Lindsay in a rural area that nobody in Lindsay other than my few neighbors even go to. So I'm part of Garvin County. I'm not even on the Lindsay water supply, even with my city water. It's not even on the Lindsay electric or water grid. It's on a rural grid. So I picked that area on purpose because it has less regulations. It has really no, I don't know what the legal regulations are. I just know nobody enforces them. Like, you can, I could tell when I picked the land that nobody was out here nitpicking anybody about anything.
Well, you know what? Now, Sherrick, I'm glad you brought that up. Because the smaller the population, the less government regulation. Like, for instance, I got a house in D.C. But D.C. is regulated out of the yin-yang. If you want to, and I think we talked about this yesterday, but with permits, getting permission, if you want to do any kind of improvements on your house, you got to get a permit. Whereas there are other parts of the country where if you know where to go, particularly in towns that have a small population, I mean, I know of several people that live in counties or towns where there's no code enforcement, you don't have to get a building permit to build, and nobody gets hurt and everything's fine. That's where I think you can, matter of fact, like the place that where you live at, I call that the real United States. D.C.,
yeah,
Baltimore, Chicago, L.A., San Diego, Miami, Orlando, that is not the real United States. The real United States, where you have some freedom, are in towns that have a population of 1,000 people or less. And I'm saying that based on experience.
Even then, I would say outside of the towns that have 1,000 people or less, because even the people in the towns will nitpick each other to a degree. It's just that they know each other, so they don't bother each other as much. But when you're an outsider, like I for instance, have had some trouble in that town when I first – I purposely avoid driving through that town when I go to pick up my kids because I thought moving to a rural area would give me no more police harassment, and I've gotten a ton more. When I drive through that town, I have funny stories that I could tell you that would probably need their own whole podcast if you wanted to hear them. But so I avoid driving through the town on purpose. But
the dynamic is different. Those towns, everybody grew up together.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you didn't
exactly
grow up there,
nice.
So that's why you probably get that kind of blowback.
Well, I'm also the only, literally, like, if you Wikipedia the town of Lindsay, it has a demographics on the Wikipedia like it would on any town, and it says something like 95% Caucasian and 2%
right.
Hispanic. It literally says, like, something that's not even a number. It says, like, 0.23% black.
I've seen those statistics.
I guess that's supposed to be me because I'm mixed, so I think they're talking about me. I couldn't really tell you. There's either a black midget in the town or I'm the mixed person they're referring to. I don't know.
right.
There's a 0.23% black person in there somewhere, and so I didn't get a good reaction. Not everybody in there is like that. I mean, I've probably met, when I do go, I try to avoid going in the town because of the two bad experiences that I had. But everybody that I've met in the town, 99% of them were nice to me. But the police themselves gave me a very, very uncomfortable problem.
and whoever they claim, if it even happened, whoever they claim allegedly called them on my suspicious look or whatever, also I would count giving me a problem. But they might not even exist. It might just been the police for making up an excuse. I don't know. But I know that my first time there, I went into town to pay my water bill and my electric bill because, like I told you yesterday, I got the city hookup first to make my wife comfortable. She wasn't comfortable with first getting off the grid. She wanted to have the backup of the city water and electric. So I got that first, and I went into town when I first moved here to pay my bill. And I had been owning land here for – I've now owned it probably about 8 years, I think, but I had at the time been owning it for about 5 or 6 years. I just didn't live on it. I would come out a couple of times a summer and do work on it. So I was driving through the town, and I went to get – I went to visit a gym and get a gym membership, and I went to a store to buy my daughters. My daughters wear head coverings. We're Christian, and they want to follow the 1 Corinthians 11:1-16 head covering thing when they're praying and stuff. So I went in there to buy them some infinity scarves. That's what they like to use. They're like a scarf that's in a circle. And I went into a shop there, and usually those infinity scarves are like $30 each. And in this little shop in Lindsay, it was like a thrift shop, but there were like everything in there looked brand new. And they had like 100 of those affinity scarves in there for like $2 each. And they said because I wanted to buy them in bulk, they'd sell them to me for cheaper. So they ended up giving me like 100 of them for like, I don't know, like $30. So I was happy. And then, so I was in a good mood. And I'm like, I'm going to join this 24-hour gym. So I went into the gym, and I was just, it's the kind of gym that's locked and you have to have a card to get in. So I had to call the owner to let me in, and the owner let me in and was walking me around the gym. And I was they told me every once in a while they had to go help somebody that was already a member because, you know, that's the priority. And so they would be like, hey, could you excuse me for a second? I need to go deal with a member. And I'd say, yeah. So I would just go look around. And I'm used to – I had never been into a fancy gym with equipment that was like machine weights. I had only been into like hood gyms, which is like barbells, dumbbells, you know. So I was just trying to figure out the equipment, and I was just looking at it, examining it. You know, that kind of equipment has instructions on it, and I'm reading it. And some guy, I don't know who he was, he claimed to be the sheriff or something, and I don't know if it's the same one that they have now or not, because this was like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I don't know. But some guy came over there. I won't describe him too in detail because I don't want to draw any more trouble to me because I don't know how big your podcast is or who in Lindsay's going to hear this. So I won't describe him too in detail, but he came up to me and like, he told me to like show him my driver's license, and I thought he was joking, because it's hard to explain why I thought he was joking, because the way he was approaching me was not appropriate at all. But I have I was raised by my mom's side of the family. I've never met my father. I lived in the hood when I lived on my own as a teenager and as an adult, but as a child I was just raised by a bunch of white people, and so my uncle and me would joke around and make like racist jokes at each other, but we're playing. So this dude said that to me, and I kind of just was thinking of my uncle. And I was like, oh, he's just playing with me. Like, me and my uncle play with each other like that. So he walks up to me. He's like, show me your ID, boy. And I was like, I just laughed. I thought he was a regular civilian because he was just wearing regular civilian clothes in a gym. And I thought he was just playing with me. And I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, right. and he just looked at me, and he was like, I'm serious. Show me your ID. And I was like, show me your driver's license. He's like, why would I show you my driver's license? He's like, because I'm a sheriff, and you have to because I'm asking you to. And I was like, I know who you're used to dealing with here, but I know perfectly well I do not have to provide you or anybody else, sheriff, police officer, FBI, or otherwise, my driver's license if I'm not behind operating a motor vehicle, and I'm not behind the wheel of our operating motor vehicle. You could ask me, I guess, for my ID, I could suppose, if you provide me with a legitimate reason as to why you feel like you're suspecting me of a crime, but you can't ask me for my driver's license because I'm not driving anything, so I'm not legally required to have a driver's license just to exist. I'm not driving.
Right.
You know, I might not have a driver's license. I might have walked here for all you know. And he's like, you're going to want to show me your driver's license if you have one, and if you don't, you better show me your ID. And I was like, I don't even know who you are. You haven't identified yourself to me. He's like, yes, I have. I told you I'm the sheriff. It's like, that's not identifying yourself to me. I could tell you that I'm Michael Jackson. That doesn't tell me that you're really him. I haven't seen your ID showing me that you have to show me a badge, some documentation, give me a badge number, something. So he pulls out his wallet and flips it out, and he's got this little Walker Texas Ranger little star badge thing. He flips it open, flips it closed. I'm like, that really didn't show me anything. I could buy a fake FBI badge on Amazon right now and flip it to you, and if I do it quick enough to where you don't see the part that says that it's a prop for a movie or something, you would think that I'm in the FBI. That didn't show me anything. And he was just like, you better quit messing with me and show me your ID. So I just was like, listen, I'm just because I live here now and I just moved here and I don't really want any problems, I'm going to show it to you just for that sake, just to show you I'm not a bad guy. But I don't have to legally show you that. I just want to make that clear. But I'm going to show it to you so that we're on a good page. And then please, you know, could you tell me why you want to see it while I'm pulling that out? And he didn't say anything. And then I pulled it out. I showed him my ID and my driver's license. And he started talking about, listen, it's not personal. I don't have a problem with you. My job is to, when somebody calls in, even if I'm off duty or on lunch or whatever, like I am now getting my workout in, I'm the sheriff here. So I have to respond when somebody makes a call, and several people called about suspicious behavior of you specifically, and it had to be you because you meet the exact description and the only one here that could meet it and on Main Street, let alone in this gym. And I was like, well, what is the suspicious activity that you're referring to? They said, well, they said in the gym you were you know, looking around at machinery, like looking at it weird and looking like you were plotting something.
I experienced because I went to college, undergraduate school in the panhandle of Texas. And during my college years, I was up in Oklahoma City, Stillwater, Oklahoma, Guymon, Oklahoma, you know, those where, to be honest about it, there were many times I know for a fact I was the only black person in that entire town.
And you know, but what? To be fair,
what saved me was I was a basketball player for a known college man. So I never got messed with. And I had the group of white folks that I was around, I had that social capital, so I never went through none of that. Now, my latest excursions to Oklahoma are like in the black township, and I know the mayor and the city council, so I never get messed with in those places. So that's how I've gotten around that way.
Well, to be fair, not that this makes it any better. It's just a different kind of racist problem. But I naturally assumed when this was happening that this was a black issue because I came from the east side and from the south side where I got that problem a lot. And whenever I drove through War Acres and Bethany to go visit my business partner, I got that even more. And when I would go to Edmond to deal with my wife to pick up my kids, I deal with it even more. So I thought it was a black issue like I was facing in the city. This is what
you
I
know
think
with small towns, like I say, 1,000 people less, or maybe even 2,500 people less. A lot of those people grew up together. A lot of those people married each other, and it's basically if they don't know you, that's when they become suspicious.
What I was told by some of the nicer people, because I was frustrated when that hit. The story's not even over. A whole separate group of police officers from a whole separate, not the sheriff's department, but their actual police, harassed me. Not 10 minutes later, when I was leaving this gym from this, and for a whole different reason, allegedly or whatever. So I was frustrated at that. So when I went and finally paid my bills and stuff and was venting about it, the people in the town at the tag agency, the police made me go to the tag agency because they had to justify a reason why they had just harassed me for over an hour. So they said that legally I had to change my address because I just moved there that day. And I said, no, I don't. I knew what the law was at the time because I was moving, and I like to know stuff like that to keep from being harassed. And let's say off the top of – I'm just making this up off the top of my head. Let's say the law says I have 10 days within the day of my move to change my ID. They said, okay, well, you just told us you just moved here. You have to go change your ID right now, and that's why we were bothering you for this whole hour. Because they literally tried to prove I stole my own car. Because it was my uncle's vehicle I was driving, and they were trying to prove I stole it. They were trying to prove that I stole the Infinity scarves from the store until I provided them receipts for everything. They were trying to prove that I broke into the gym until the freaking gym owner said I didn't, and all of this crazy stuff. But what the people at the different bill companies and the tag agency and the water company stuff told me is they think that probably it wasn't not that this is okay. They were just telling me their honest belief, not that it's any better. But they think, and if your viewers are confused about what I'm about to say, tell them to go look at my Instagram
photos of me. I'm mixed, and when I worked at the airport, I got confused for every race under the sun. I got people walking up to me, talking to me in Ethiopian and Cuban and Moroccan and Jordanian and Hebrew and Aramaic, because people going through an airport are from all over the world, and they just, if they see somebody, if they don't speak English and they see somebody they think looks like they speak their language, they'll come try to talk to you to get you to translate for
right.
them. So I guess I look like I could pass. Not to me. I'm me. I just look like me. But I know I must look like several different races for that to happen, because that doesn't – people don't just walk up to white people or black people and start talking to them in Hebrew and Aramaic and Spanish and all kinds of different languages all the time. So I think I passed – and I've gotten in a couple of fights, and I've got my nose broke a couple of times, and I have a little bump in my nose that wasn't naturally there. So I think that a lot of people confuse me with, like, Middle Eastern. Because I'm light-skinned, mm-hmm. I've got light brown eyes, and I have a kind of lumpy, like, Middle Easternish nose, but it's because it was broken a couple times in fights. So I think that because of the fact that I purchased a bunch of hair coverings for my daughters, and because of the fact that they think and perceived me to look Arabic or Muslim or whatever, I think they thought I was Muslim, and that's what seemed to be insinuating with because first he insinuated that I looked like I was plotting something in the gym, and I'm like, what do you mean by that? And he's like, well, they just look like you might have been planting something, some kind of explosive device, plotting something weird, doing something to the, you know, trying to do something, you know, terroristic-like or something. So, and then not 10 minutes later when I leave the gym, I just decided not to get a gym pass because I'm like, this dude's going to be working out here. He might harass me for the rest of my life or do something worse. I don't want to work out here. So I left, and then I got in my car. This was when I was separated from my wife, but she had not yet legally divorced me, and we still talked a lot and stuff, and I called her to let her know what just happened, and we were laughing about it. I was aggravated. She was laughing about it. Then I started laughing a little bit, but I was still mad. I was being made to feel a little bit better about it. While I'm sitting in my car, it's parked. The keys are not even in the ignition. The engine is not started. My foot's not on the brake, so my brake lights aren't on. There's no indication that this car is being used as a motor vehicle at the moment. I get two SUVs hit the back of my car on both corners of it and push it up against the sidewalk. And then another police vehicle hops the curb and then pulls in front of my car on the sidewalk, so that if I were to try to turn my car and leave, it'd be literally impossible, which I wasn't doing. And so I was just disturbed at this moment. So I'm like, I'm not even cooperating with these people like that anymore. It's not going to be problematic, but I'm not like with the dude when I gave him my ID with no reason provided to me for why. I was like, I'm not doing that now, because that didn't help, because obviously it got me here. So I just cracked my window, and he's like, roll your window all the way down. I said, I'm not doing that. He said, I need you to roll your window out. No, you don't need me to do that. You need to be able to communicate with me. That's all the law says. I'm not even operating a motor vehicle, so I don't have to give you my license. I'll give you my ID, and then if you want to pull me over again when I start driving and play games, I'll give you my license at that point. But I'll give you my ID for right now. Here, all you need is my window cracked for that. I'm not even playing yellow games anymore. And he said, sir, we got calls that you broke and entered into – these shops, and that you sold things, and we're going to need you. I said, what shops did I break and enter into that you got reports of? He pointed at three places. One was it said on the sign it was a nutrition center, and like I've told you on this call, I'm very, very into that. So I saw a nutrition center. I got excited. I tried to go in it. It was locked. Put my eyes up against the window, saw, oh, this isn't even in business. Like, this is just a sign of a nutrition center. There's nothing in here. There's nothing. There's no shelves. It's an empty room. So it's just one of those old abandoned shops in a small town. So that's all that was. I pulled on the door. I looked in the window. I left. Then I went to the thrift store, bought my daughter's head covering, and went to the gym. So they said I tampered with the door, maybe broke in and climbed in the window or something, all this crazy. I'm like, do you see – that whole wall is made out of glass and that door is made out of glass. Do you see any broken glass? They're like, well, you could have went around back. I'm like, did you send an officer around back to check if there was any broken glass or any breaking and entering signs before you came to harass me? And he's like, well, when we get a call, we have to – I was like, I understand that. You have to investigate it. Part of investigating whether or not somebody could have broken into a place is to see if the place has even been broken into. And if it clearly has not been, then if the person went inside, that clearly means they have a key. Then they didn't break in. They own the place. So if there's no broken windows, you really don't have a reason to even come talk to me that you've done your investigation. Did you do that? No, I didn't do that. So – I'm like, okay, so, and the other place you said I broke into or something, they were like, well, you didn't break into. You went in there, and they said you stole some things. And I asked them where it was. They were talking about the thrift shop that I went to. I was like, dude, I went in there and had a 20-minute conversation with a nice old lady in there. I don't think she called you. I really, honest to God, don't.
maybe a customer that was in there called you just to screw with me, but there really wasn't anybody in there other than the owner that I noticed. So I think you're honestly making things up. And he was like, we still, it doesn't matter what you think, you have to show me evidence that you have a receipt and that you didn't steal anything. I was like, you can't prove a negative, officer. I cannot prove to you I didn't steal something. I can prove to you that I did buy something. I cannot prove to you that I didn't steal something. Nor is it my job to prove to you that I didn't steal something. It is your job to prove to me that I did steal something. So I could give you the bag that I purchased and show you everything in it and let you dig through it, and I could give you the receipt. And as long as it lines up with everything that's in that bag, that does still not prove to you that I didn't steal anything. That just proves to you that I was a smart enough thief, if I stole something, that I wouldn't put what I stole in the bag with what I purchased, so that if you harass me, I could show you a receipt and a bag that lines up with the receipt. That any thief that's smart enough to steal is smart enough to do that 9 times out of 10. I know that, and I'm not even a thief. You got to know that as an officer. So you know perfectly well I cannot prove to you I didn't steal anything. And as an officer, you also know that it's not my job to prove to you I didn't steal anything. It's your job to prove to me that I'm guilty, not for me to prove to you that I'm innocent. That's not how this works. I'm not going to sit here and prove to you that I didn't do something. That's literally impossible to do. I can prove to you that there's gold in China by overturning a rock with some gold under it. I cannot prove to you that there is no gold in China without being in China to prove it. It's not possible. I can't do that. So I can't prove to you I didn't steal something. You can show me a video camera of me stealing something, which is not possible for you to do because I didn't steal anything, and that would prove I did steal something. But I cannot show you a video. What am I supposed to show you? I'm going to go get the surveillance evidence of me not stealing. Like, you could just say that, oh, when you were out of the sight of that camera and that shelf was blocking you, you slipped it into your pocket or you put some bubble gum. I mean, I can't prove I didn't steal something. That's nonsense. And he was like, well, if you want to leave here and you don't want to, you know, we're going to escalate this, it'll get ugly, or you can show us the evidence that you paid for what you claim you bought. I was like, fine, whatever, man. So I gave him the bag and I gave him the receipt. And he's like, what is this? And he's digging through it. And he's like, these are all, I think he called them, I don't remember what he called them. He called them whatever Muslims call them. I just call them
scarves
or affinity scarves. But he called them, I can't think of the word. But there's a word that all Muslims call them, and
well, you see,
I don't call
you're
them
dealing with. It sounds like you were dealing with people. This is where cultural differences come in. You're dealing with
yeah.
people that live in a you changed comfort zones. You went from a big city urban environment to a
mm-hmm.
small town rural environment, and some people in those rural towns, just like a lot of people in your lot, like, for instance, there's some people that were born in Bronx, New York, or Brooklyn, New York, and they haven't been outside of that borough in New York City. At the
yeah.
same time, there are people that, those people that you ran into that night, or that day, or
mm-hmm.
whenever it was, they haven't
yeah.
been outside of where you met them at. Their whole world, their whole life has been right there. Some
yeah,
people,
yeah.
now I discovered this when I was going to college in Texas. The first black people, and we're talking about a college student, 17, 18, you know, 20 years old. The first time they ever met somebody that didn't look like them was when they went to college.
Yeah.
You know, that's what,
that's true.
I couldn't fathom that at first, but I grew up in D.C. where you got everybody. But. And from people that might be from Garmin, Oklahoma, or Dalhart, Texas, or someplace like that, you know, the first time they've only seen them on the news, but they've never met them face to face. So it's a culture
right.
shock to some people.
That's what I think it was, and I don't think that it was
right.
based on being black in this particular instance. I think not that it's right, not that because Muslim people
mm-hmm.
shouldn't have to deal with racism, black people shouldn't, Spanish people shouldn't, white people shouldn't. I don't think
right.
anybody should have to deal with racism. I think you could be racist to white people, and that's wrong too. So, but I just clarify. I don't think they were being racist against me because they thought I was black. I think they were being racist against me because they thought I was like a Muslim from the Middle East, basically.
Well, first thing,
and that's
probably haven't seen. First thing, in person, you could have been, I don't know, I can't prove it, you could have been the first black person ambiguous-looking person that they've ever met.
I am. I
in
have
person.
To be because
right.
if their Wikipedia demographics are to be believed, I would have to be because their demographics say that there's like, it says that there's like, I don't know, like 5 Hispanics here and like a couple Asians and 95% white or something. And then, but that the black, it says 0.023 or whatever. And it doesn't have any listing for Arabic or any kind of
Middle Eastern race. So I would be the only one of either that they would see out, probably outside of their.
Yes, too. So you are probably the first person that they in person. I'm not talking about in the news and the movies that they've met like
yeah.
that. And then, they have no social context because most of their friends and relatives don't know anybody outside of their comfort zone in that particular town. So meeting you is a culture shock.
Yeah, and that's just my assumption. I can only go off of their demographics that Wikipedia has, which might be incorrect,
right.
and off of my experience. But I have not seen a black person here. But to be fair, ever since that was my first encounter. That was my welcome to the neighborhood. So ever since then,
mm-hmm.
I have made it a point to – I started paying any bills that could be paid online, and any that – this is a small town, so some of their stuff you can't pay digitally. So I still have to go in to pay the water bill and stuff like that whenever I'm not using any off-grid source. And I keep paying it just because I wanna have that as a backup, like because I think my wife's idea was a good idea, even though I didn't agree with it. I think it's good to have a backup or whatever. But so I only go in there when I absolutely have to, or when I'm out of gas and I need to make a run to the city and the closest gas to go get my kids in Edmond, and the closest gas station is the one, you know, 20 minutes from me in that town, as opposed to in a whole other small town. So I go in there when I have to. But when the few times I have gone in there. I've probably only been in that town collectively, to be fair, in the last 3 years, probably only 30 times, and for little brief spurts just to go in and get a sub sandwich from Subway or to get some gas or to pay a water bill on my way out of town. But I've never personally seen a black person in there. That's all I can say. I mean, I've never went to the church.
Yeah,
or,
I was in college in Texas. I've been all through that neck of the woods. It was countless times.
Mm.
I knew I was the only black person. But then again, I've been, like when I was over in Europe, same thing. But now, one of the things I do for protection is I typically make friends with somebody. So if I'm seen in public, I'm seen in person. I mean, seen in public with somebody, when I was in Asia, well, I'm palling around with one of the local Asians there in the Philippines or China or wherever I'm at. If I'm in Texas or Oklahoma, well, now I can roam free because I know those areas. But when I got acclimated to those areas, basically, I was always with a white person, never had any problems. So you were out there alone, though.
That's another thing is the only times I was about to say exactly what you just said. The only times that I've been in the town for extended periods of time is with my uncle. And my uncle – He's an interesting character because when he's like wearing a tank top and he's like a cowboy and he like wears when he's at home, he'll wear a tank top and some jeans. When he's going out, around his property, he'll wear an Argyle like cowboy shirt and a button up shirt and a cowboy hat and cowboy boots. But when he's out in public, he'll either wear long button up shirt with his cowboy stuff or he'll wear a suit and his cowboy hat. So either way, he looks very, very country, small town white guy. And so
they typically leave you alone.
They absolutely treat me totally and 100% different when he's there. I never feel the need to, like when I go to the gas station or the Subway when I'm there alone, I feel a very clear presence. And it might just be because of my first bad experience. I might be projecting that because all the other people are actually nice to me. I just feel like, you know, the first two police encounters that I had here, all of those people were nice to me too. But unless those police are lying, somebody was being nice to my face, but then called the police talking about I look scary or something. So I'm always uncertain about are these people being nice to me, but then they're going to, you know, get me hurt. And I don't want to deal with it. So I just, I get in and out. But when my uncle's here, he's like, no, we're going to eat inside of the Subway. What are you talking about? Leave and go back to the house. No, we're going to sit here and shop around while we're getting gas. We'll be in there for 20 or 30 minutes and everybody will talk to us and be nice. And so maybe they would do that to me anyway if I stayed in there long enough, and I'm just scared to do it now because of the first two encounters, or maybe it's because of my uncle. But I think it's a little of both. I'm sure that
if they saw you with your uncle and then they see you after that alone, you know, you're not as much of a stranger to them as when they first saw you.
Yeah, and exactly. That's another thing.
Because I know, like, in Washington, D.C., I was in, on the west side of D.C., the extreme west side of D.C., Spring Valley is the neighborhood, which they have high-end houses there. And yeah. I was showing somebody, you know, showing in Washington, D.C. So I took them to this particular exclusive area. And, it, you know, they got police patrols. And the Metropolitan Police pulled up, you know, I knew he was going to pull me over. So what I did was, because I had a white person in the car with me, I pulled over and I said, let's get out and let's walk the neighborhood. And when we did that and they saw the white dude, he just kept on going past. And that's in D.C.
Yeah. Yeah,
which at that time was supposed to be Chocolate City. It's no longer Chocolate City, though. So I just adjust to how the cultural climate is wherever I'm at. And I've been to 13 countries, never had any problems with race.
I don't have them except for in specific places. But when I'm able, like you said, when I'm able to actually dialogue with people long enough for them to – not that you should have to do that for just to be safe mm-hmm. and comfortable, but when I'm able to dialogue with somebody first before an incident like that happens, then I don't have a problem. But in this particular incident,
you know
it just
what?
Happened to happen
before.
I'm glad
you say that because by dialoguing with the people – now, you're right. You don't have to, and you shouldn't have to. But by dialoguing with them, you're building social capital – and when you build that social capital, you're building allies. And then people have a tendency to leave you alone.
Yeah, because, like, after that experience, I went out of my way not to interact with them at all, except when, like I said, when I'm with my uncle or when I have to. But in the places that I did interact with them with my uncle, if I go back to them, whenever I went back to them after that, they treat me a whole different way. So there's some of that, too, as well. But, yeah, you shouldn't have to.
Like,
say,
if a white dude came through there. Yeah, it's true. It is what it is.
Like my uncle,
but
they
if
don't
a white
know
guy
either.
Came through there, or any nationality came through there, if they in a small town, if they don't know you, they're going to be suspicious.
Yeah.
And that's I find that true. I've been to 13 countries. I find that hold true in all those places. But once they see that you're cool with one person. It seems like that whole town or village or whatever you want to call it, you're left alone. Because, I've been walking alone by myself 2, 3 o'clock in the morning over in Germany. Small town Germany, absolutely no fear. Anything like that. Now, let's bring this back to, now, like I said, you got out of the city because some people are afraid to leave the city to go to a small town. But I'm looking at, man, why stay in hell? You got these high property taxes, so you've made a transit. Now, how many years have you been off the grid with this, or how many years have you been out of the city?
Out of the city? I moved here in mid to end 2018.
Mm-hmm.
I've owned the land for many years, but I actually lived here because what I was doing was I was – like I told you yesterday, Shaw, I was trying to slowly build it up to where I didn't intend to live out here until I had like an actual like brick and mortar house built out here and everything ready in my perfect imagination for my wife.
Right.
But then my wife left, took the kids. Since she's the woman and Section 8 is all of that was on her name. All of that stuff was in her name. So when she left me, that left me. So then I had to leave that house because she took her, you know, her all of her benefits and stuff elsewhere. So I was like, okay, I guess I have to. My
so
grandma
basically,
lived with
she
us
decided
time.
To stay on the grid, and you decided to get off the grid.
Well, it was decided for me. I was going to get off the grid eventually, either way. But yeah, I didn't really have a choice at that point. But at the same time, I was only trying to wait till everything was perfect because I'm a husband and a father. And what I can do and what I want my wife and kids to have to do are two different things. Like I could live primitive wilderness survival. So I'm a prepper. You could drop me naked in the woods and the jungle and I could build a wiki up teepee out of trees and vines and leaves and dirt and be fine. And I could dig a hole in a cave, but I wasn't about to have my wife and kids out before the air conditioning is set up, before the power and electric and water.
Demcat?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, he's a YouTuber. He's a prepper also. Well, he continued.
Oh, what is his name?
Demcat. That's his YouTube name. Demcat. His name. Well, what's his Reginald something? I forgot his last name. But Demcat channel. He's a black YouTuber. He's up in. I think he's in Kentucky right now.
I don't think so. Which is weird because I'm subscribed to most
You know what, I'll text you one of his videos later today.
Talking about Prepper YouTuber, once you see that Back to Eden documentary film,
mm-hmm.
go type in that. I don't know, maybe you already know him. His name is That Nub, L2 Survive That Nub on YouTube. L2.
No, I don't know him. I'll look him up, though.
Yeah, he's got the most footage of Paul Gauci doing his Back to Eden garden tours. He goes out there once in the winter or once in the summer every year for like the past 7-8 years now, and he's got like 20 videos of that, and he does these long, because most people go out there and they'll take little footage of the walkthrough Paul Gauci does, but little clips. This guy tapes it from beginning to end, and Paul Gauci will go on, and he's like me, but an old white guy. He'll go on and talking for 7 or 8 hours on any subject if you let him. So he'll be out there talking for hours about his garden, about how it relates to life, the Bible, health, wellness, whatever. And That Nub will tape it from beginning to end. And I'm telling you, that guy, Paul Gauci, as much as his information on gardening is life-changing, if you just listen to the random ramblings that he says of completely seemingly unrelated stuff that he relates back to gardening with analogies and stuff, you'll learn so much from Paul Gauci on those walkthroughs that perhaps are even – it's hard to say something's more valuable than growing your own food because you literally need that to live. But spiritually and mentally and just in every other way possible, just lifestyle advice, mentoring, everything. That guy is so wise and smart, it's stupid. It's crazy. So go on to L2 Survive That Nub YouTube channel. Type in Paul Gauci Back to Eden Garden Tour with L2 Survive That Nub, and you'll see all of those, and just pick one. Pick the most recent one. I recommend you pick one of the summertime ones because his garden is obviously more productive in the summer than in the winter. And he's in Swim, Washington, near Canada, so it's very.
Okay.
It's the fact that he can grow anything in winter is crazy, and it's only because of his garden.
Does he use a greenhouse?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't believe in greenhouses because he does a lot of weird experiments and stuff, and everything he says he backs up. But he's experimented with like sending in tomatoes with a greenhouse, glass greenhouse, a plastic greenhouse, and then a greenhouse that he has one greenhouse that he has the glass on the sides of it, but he took the glass off the top of it, so it's basically not a greenhouse because it's not holding in warm air anymore at that point, but it's just kind of shielding from the cold wind and stuff from the sides, but it's not keeping the hot air in the top. But he did actually experiment sending in the tomatoes he grew in the greenhouse with no top to it. And then the greenhouse with glass to it, and it's totally night and day different. And I like him because he doesn't only do scientific experiments, he does practical ones. So one of the people that came through on one of his tours was a scientist, and he took that's how he does these experiments. So people will ask him questions, and he'll be like, I don't know, test it. If you're a scientist, test it. And he'll give them little samples of different stuff, and they'll go test it, and they'll give them the results. And they found out, like, there's just hundreds and hundreds of more phytonutrients and phytochemicals in his tomatoes that had no top to the greenhouse, because it's letting in different – I don't know. We can't explain – we don't know how everything works in nature, but something that the sun has in it that is being blocked by that glass is affecting chemically on a molecular level the nutritional value of those tomatoes. So he doesn't even use greenhouses anymore. And he's also done experiments on himself and people. So what he'll do is he's a white guy. And so, like, whereas you probably, I would imagine, and I'm mixed, and if I go in the sun, I just get darker. I'll just look more black. And, you know, black people go in the sun, they get super, super dark. White people go in the sun, they get red, burned, and then they peel. And some mixed people do that too, but they'll usually get dark first, and then if they're in there a super long time, they might peel and stuff too. But they won't get really red, they'll just get really dark and peel. So he's one of those white people that he'll get really, really red and peel naturally. Now, so when he's done experiments where he goes off of his diet and eats a normal American diet and stuff for a little span of time, and then where he's on a plant-based diet but with stuff grown in his greenhouse and not in his garden, and then with stuff grown in his garden. When he ate just he went on like a tomato fast, and he ate just the tomatoes from his greenhouse for a couple weeks, he burned and peeled. When he ate the tomatoes from his basically non-greenhouse because it didn't have a glass top to it at all, he would stay in the sun as long as he wants, and he would get like an orangish brownish color, like he would tan. Like if you were to put a white person some of that brown tanning oil on them to make them chemically darker to look like they're tanning when they really aren't tanning, you know. He would just tan when he eats those tomatoes from his garden that didn't grow in a greenhouse. So he believes that it's something in some of those phytochemicals that's missing in the greenhouse ones that's present in the non-greenhouse ones is that whatever it is, he says that what he thinks whatever keeps those, he says that the greenhouse tomatoes, when you put them in the sun, they start to peel, and they start to, just kind of like a white person's skin, like they start to peel. The sun damages them.
Right.
Whereas when you put the ones that were grown in the sun and leave them out in the sun, nothing happens. They just shine. They just reflect the sunlight like a shiny, clean tomato would do. And so he thinks that your skin is being affected by whatever is in that tomato that causes the one to burn in rupture and the other one not to burn in rupture. And it makes sense to me. I think that he's probably right. You know, sometimes a lot of people don't want to accept certain things if there's not like, you know, a scientific double blind study test and stuff and anecdotal evidence like what he's talking about. But I mean, I'm a proponent of listening to your body as well. So, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious if you're eating one thing and you burn and peel and you eat another thing and you tan, that it's obviously something's in that other thing that's causing you not to peel. It's good for your skin, you know? So, I mean.
A lot of people don't listen to their body. I want to play this short audio and then I want to throw out a scenario for you. Hold on.
Say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars it is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Now, I played that audio on here several times over the years. But I played it there. I'm putting it in a different context due to the fact that we have Shurik as a guest on today. In the United States, there's 3,800 documented ghost towns. There are probably more than that, but that's documented. In the state of Oklahoma, because Shurik's in Oklahoma, the state of Oklahoma has 236 ghost towns. All right. Methuen, and I probably butchered their name, County has the most ghost towns in Oklahoma with 13, and there are 11 ghost towns within a 25 mile radius of Norman, Oklahoma. Once again, every state in the union has ghost towns. Now, but we're talking about Oklahoma today. Now, let me get back to my studio here. And he mentioned that they picked up a house through the tax sale. Well, people can get together. We can do it on an individual basis if you got the cash, or you can get together with 9 or 10 of your best friends and or more, and you can go in and buy up one of these ghost towns. Okay. And some of these towns throughout the United States have like 500 people or less, like IXL, Oklahoma. Matter of fact, Sherrick, have you heard of IXL, Oklahoma? Wait a minute. Yes, Sherrick, have you heard of IXL, Oklahoma?
I have not.
51 people live in IXL. All right. What do you think about the idea of you can do it as a family or you can do it as a group of people going in one of these ghost towns that most people don't even know that exist and doing what you did on an individual basis, but you're spreading it out to, you can call it Sherrickville, Oklahoma. What about that? What's your thoughts on that?
I'm already working on something like that, but a little bit different.
Okay. All right. Great. I like that thing.
I think that's a good idea. But I've gotten to the point, and I think that people, I kind of touched on that yesterday. I think that people that live in, like in Oklahoma, for instance, on the east side, I think that all of those people should buy up all the empty lots and grow food on it in between their houses, and then they could feed themselves. They could try to lobby to change the laws about well water and get some wells dug and get some backyard chickens, and they could buy up the houses and rehab them and flip them together with their, you know, combined tax money and stuff like that. But that's nothing you can force on people. That's something that people have to just decide to do, and they don't want to, whatever reason.
Right.
And I think that your idea is a good idea as well with ghost towns. I'm personally working on, if you go on YouTube and type in Richard, not Richard, like with a D, Rich Art, with a like rich, like wealthy rich, and then art, like uh-huh. like paintings, Rich Art.
Rich Art.
So, yeah, Rich Art. It's a okay. weird name. It's RICHART, Rich Art. SOA, SOWA, Rich Art SOA.
Okay,
type in Rich Art SOA and, yeah, Mobile Floating Island. That dude, his wife divorced him, took all of his money, took all of his kids, took everything he owned, had him on alimony and screwed him over in every way possible that the government allows a woman to do. And this man said to himself, well, if I go back and start over, I'm in the process of starting over, so I know exactly what he's talking about because I got the same thing that happened to me. So this dude's saying, if I go and start over, she's just going to benefit from what, if I go buy land, if I go start a business, if I go make money, she's just going to get it forever. She's going to be entitled to it forever, even though we're divorced, because that's how our country is set up crooked like that as well. Once you've married a woman, she pretty much can own you if she wants to. She can get alimony forever and get child support, and alimony and child support can be raised at any given time. So the more you start to succeed, kind of like I said, when you're trying to get off of food stamps or Section 8 and you get a raise at your job. Well, if you're divorced and you're on alimony and child support and you go quit your job and start a business and start getting a raise in life, you're gonna go from, you know, $500, $800, $1,000 a month of child support to $5,000 a month child support and alimony. And they don't have an upper level cap in most states. So this guy said, now screw that. I'm not going to go buy land that she can just take from me and start a business that she can just keep the money from. So he was homeless because she took everything he owned. And instead of starting over and going and buying some more land in America or anywhere else, because every country's just got their own version of a different flavor of tyranny, this dude started collecting plastic water bottles, drinking bottles, like when you drink water or you drink a soda, uh-huh. 2 liter or whatever, any size
right.
water bottle with a lid. And he would go collect those. And basically, when you put the lid on an empty water bottle, if you've ever sat it in water, it's a pontoon. It floats. Now, one is not going to float anything of significant weight. It'll float itself. But if you try to put a brick on it or something, it's not going to do that. But when you put them together in a bag or a net and tie them off together, hundreds of them, They can float any amount of weight that you want up to and including a house or a mansion. So this dude put together about, I think he said 250, I think in his 60 foot by 80 foot mobile floating tropical island that he made, I think he used 250,000 plastic bottles that he collected over the span of a couple of years, just taking them out of trash cans. He would go take, like when you buy a bag of oranges at the store and they come in that little netting, he would take that netting right to potato sacks or to orange sacks or whatever out of the trash. He would put the water bottles in them and tie them up, and he would just keep piling them up. He, like, you know how homeless people will find a place in the woods or under a bridge where they store their stuff. He would just keep piling these bottles and bags up in a dark place, because plastic gets brittle in sunlight, so you don't want to store it in a bright place. And he would store it in a dark place in the middle of some little rural patch of tiny, not woods, it's not like actual woods, but, like, you know, there's patches of land where there's no houses in the middle of neighborhoods where there's just a bunch of trees and stuff that's basically woods, but surrounded right by city streets. And so he went and stored plastic bottles there, and he was like in Texas on the border of Mexico where there's an ocean and stuff. And so he got enough of those bottles together. Then he started collecting pallets, like the wooden pallets that, like, people ship things to 7-Eleven and Walmart in and stuff, and they
yeah
throw them away.
Mm-hmm.
He started collecting those, and he would collect, like, wire hangers, and he would tie the pallets together with wire hangers or with any ropes that he could get his hands on, and then he would set them in the ocean. And underneath them, he would have, before he set them in the ocean, he'd put the bags of bottles underneath them, so it made the pallets float. And then he started out with a little section that he had floating in the water. Maybe it was like 5 foot by 5 foot. Put a little bit of tarp on it, a little bit of plastic bags on it, whatever he could get his hands on, plastic grocery bags, tarp, whatever, to hold the dirt from falling through. And he would shovel dirt and sand off of the land, put it onto the little 5 foot by 5 foot thing. And he had it anchored. And then he would expand it. He would add more water bottles, more pallets, more tarp, more soil, more bottles, more pallets, more tarp, more soil, until he had himself a 80 foot by 60 foot, I believe, mobile floating tropical island. He planted mangrove trees on it, because mangroves, unlike most trees can only grow in fresh water underneath them, with a freshwater source underneath them. Mangroves can grow in salt water, and they have roots that wrap around and bind around anything that they can get their hands on. So he planted them there because, A, they could grow in the salt water underneath the island without him having to water them, and then B, the roots of them wound and wound and wound around these water bottle nets and these pallets, because he knew that the pallets were going to rot because they're wood and they're in water. So he wanted to see if the mangrove roots would take the place of the pallets before the pallets rotted, and that's exactly what they did. They wrapped around all of the nets and water bottles, and the island made itself an island out of the tree roots holding it together instead of wire hangers and pallets that all rotted away. So now it was just an island made out of tree roots and soil that was floating because of plastic bottles. And he's built multiple of those, and they work. And if you want to, the heavier something you want, he had a three-story, three-bedroom house that he built on it. He built I guess you could call it a tiny house. It wasn't really all that tiny, but it was smaller than a normal house, but it wasn't as tiny as a tiny house. But it was a three-story little small house he built out of pallets and junk and trash on this island. He did all of this with no money, with nothing. I'm not saying that you can't make a nicer version of it with money and everything. I'm just saying this homeless man built himself an 80-foot by 60-foot nation of his own. That's what it is, essentially. That's a micronation. That's a tiny nation. That's a 60-foot by 80-foot enough you could put a small neighborhood on. And he could have kept expanding it as long as and big as he wanted to. He didn't do that because he wasn't trying to build a micronation. He wasn't trying to be sovereign. He just wanted a place that his wife couldn't go to court and say, look, he owns an acre, let me have some money from him. You know, he bought an acre. She couldn't take him to court and say, look, he collected trash to live on, that means he should give me more money. So that's the only reason he did it. He wasn't trying to start a revolution or start a micronation, or
he was thinking ahead of the system.
He was just thinking on a smaller scale, but in a big way, but with something that you could take and do a lot more with than what he did with it. I mean, you could literally, every country, America and every other country, has an economic zone outside in the water, exactly 200 miles outside of the beach line. So that means anything within that 200 miles, that water allegedly belongs to that nation. So if you put any – and that's where he had his park. So he still technically was – you know, he was under American law, and he had to do certain things certain ways, and he had to get his island plated like it was a boat, and had to have certain kind of life rafts on it, and he had to have fire hydrants on it, and all. And not that any of those things are bad ideas, except for the getting it plated part. All the other ones are kind of common sense, but he had to do it. Is my problem with it, because it was in American water. They
right.
And they made him pay taxes on it like it was a boat. They made him pay like the kind of taxes you would pay on parking your boat in their bay. So if he could move, if he would have just, and he was gonna eventually do that. But he changed his mind, got married, and he's living on the land now. He just went back to square one, and probably gonna get divorced and screwed again. But if he would have moved his island 200 miles outside of the water line of the United States and of Mexico, that's international waters. He would have been able to literally have his own laws on his own land. He could have built more than one house on an 80-foot by 60-foot property. And it'd be like a small neighborhood. You expand it any bigger than that, now you've got a small town. Any bigger than that, you got a city. You could make it a state. You could make it a country. You could do whatever you wanted to. The planet Earth is 70%+ water. I don't even know why they call it the planet Earth, because Earth means ground, and the planet Earth is 70-something% water, not ground. So it should really
You're
be
right.
called the planet sea, really, the planet ocean.
Right,
if you look
and
at
I
Earth
think
from space,
99% of all living beings or creatures on
are
the planet,
in the water.
There you go, are in the water.
Yeah, they're in the water. And that's food, by the way. If you're not a vegan, that's food. I mean, you can literally, like, what he did all kinds of really cool things. He had – because he was going to move it out into the ocean before he changed his mind and settled down with some lady and moved on to land. But he was going to turn the bottom, because the bottom of his island was already a net. It was just a big net holding bottles. But he was going to, under that, make it another bigger net where it had multiple places that you could that fish could swim into it but not escape. There's a certain kind of net you can make where they can swim in but not out of. And he had an opening in the middle of his island to where the ocean was under the island exposed so that he could fish through that. So he already could fish individually with his fishing pole out of the ocean. But if he wanted to, he was going to eventually do it. He just changed his mind. He could have put a net around the whole bottom of his island. And every time he caught a fish, most people, whether it's a fish or whether it's a land animal like a cow, most American people anyway, don't eat the intestines. Most people throw that away. Even homesteaders
right.
usually throw that away. You can eat that. Africans eat that. My friend is from Kenya. I eat that stuff because I learned that from them, and Native Americans ate all that. But most people in America don't eat none of that. So what you can do is you can throw all of your intestines of the fish waste in that hole in the middle of your island that leads down to that net, and you can throw all your plant waste from your garden in there too, because some fish eat meat and some fish eat plants, just like land animals. There's carnivores and herbivores in the ocean. And the fish will smell that food, and they will come in there, and then they can't get out, and they don't need to get out anyway because you're providing them food regularly. But then you now have an unlimited supply of food under that island to where they only eat when you feed them. So if you want to make it – so whereas when you're fishing out of the ocean, those fish can be full or they could be hungry, so you might be sitting there for hours waiting. The fish that are trapped under your island only eat when you feed them on a feeding time. So just like a domestic animal, they start to learn, oh, if you feed them on a schedule, they learn. So let's say you're going to feed them every day at 3 o'clock. And you want some fish for dinner, then at 2:55, you drop your hook in there. You got to fish immediately because they're hungry, because they're waiting for their feeding schedule in 5 minutes, and you don't have to wait at all. And now you can now you can cut that fish open, throw its guts in there, and now they have a feeding frenzy. And so that's an unlimited food supply, not to mention the gardening that you have on the land, because you can back to Eden Garden on the island, because that's literally what that island is a giant back to Eden Garden. You're putting compost on top of tarp, and now you've got a perfect garden. That is your land. Your whole land is fertile soil. But so you've got an unlimited meat supply from the ocean. You've got an unlimited vegetable supply from your land and from the ocean, because most seaweeds are superfoods. You can buy seaweeds at Whole Foods. Like, there's several different kinds of seaweeds that are health foods that people spend a lot of money on at Whole Foods. But then on top of that, you've got an unlimited water supply. People don't think of that because it's salt water, and salt water will kill you if you drink it. But salt water is nothing but water with salt in it. You can literally boil salt water. I mean, there are more intricate, fancy ways you can do it, but you can literally take a pot of water and boil salt water, and the steam will go over into you have a lid on whatever you're boiling it in with a tube leading over to another pot. The steam will go over. Now you've got fresh water on one side and sea salt for free on the other side. Sea salt's healthy, and fresh water is essential for life. And now you've got both, and you don't have to pay for the sea salt, and you don't have to pay for the water. And most people say that's not sustainable, like especially on a mobile floating island, because you need wood to start a fire typically to make heat, or you need electricity, one or the other. Well, first of all, you can have solar panels on a mobile island. But second of all, you don't even need electricity or wood to do what I'm talking about, because you can get what's called a Fresnel lens, which is basically
a
giant
magnifying
glass.
Man, I got one of those. One of my hobbies is solar cooking. I got like little small Fresnel lenses, but I got a big one.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I can scramble an egg in about 15 seconds, and I can cook a steak in under 2 minutes.
I'm talking about then. Imagine pointing a Fresnel lens. Imagine one of those giant pots of water, a giant pot like you see in a school cafeteria where they're making enough stew for, 5,000 kids or whatever. Giant pot like that filled with ocean water, and you point your Fresnel lens at it. Heat that water up. You point the Fresnel lens. You can point it straight at the water, or you can point it at the base of the pot. It doesn't really matter which one, as long as the pot heats or the water heats, either way. And with a lid on top of that, and then a tube like a water hose leading to another pot of equal size, and not very long from then, with the heat that the sun produces with a Fresnel lens, you're going to have pure water on one side.
Oh, yeah, man. I wear welder's goggles and I have some gloves because it's extremely white heat. You're not supposed to look at it directly, so I had to wear welder goggles when I'm cooking with that. But yeah, that's been one of my hobbies for about 12 years now.
So you have everything you need right there for an unlimited fresh water supply if you lived on the ocean. And another problem that Richard Soa had with living on the ocean is that just like being too close to land puts you underneath United States laws or Mexican laws or wherever you're based out of, it also puts you right in the zone of hurricanes, tsunamis, and typhoons and things like that, because that's where those things happen. Now, people think that happens everywhere in the ocean. It doesn't. It happens. It's just like a tornado. It has to have a certain climate and a certain environment to happen. Now, that does not happen on the equator, in the equator, not right outside of the equator. Right outside of the equator, all of the nice islands that people pay to go on vacation on and stuff, they're right outside of one side or the other of the equator. That's why they have perfect weather pretty much year-round most of the time, but then every once in a while, a couple times a year, they have these crazy tsunamis and typhoons and tidal waves and all this. Florida, Hawaii, Belize, it doesn't matter, wherever it is, because these islands are not – they're just where they're at. They weren't put there on purpose by a human. They're just where they are at. So there are no islands on – there are not really very many islands on the actual equator. The equator goes all the way around the Earth. So there's a lot of space on the equator, and there aren't really any islands actually in the equator. And in the equator, in the 6,000 years of recorded human history, no one has ever documented a tsunami, a hurricane, a typhoon, or any kind of sea storm other than just a regular rainstorm if you look at a lake when it's raining, it'll get a little wavy or whatever, and that's about it. There's no real storms on the equator. So his island, he's had like three or four of them over the span of the last like 30 years, and every once in a while a typhoon or a tidal wave will hit him and destroy him, just like it would destroy anything, just like it would destroy a house, just like it destroys anything. So people look at that and they think, well, there's something wrong with that island. That's fragile or something. No, it's not. That happens to skyscrapers. It happens to houses. It's like saying there's something wrong with houses if a tornado or an earthquake destroys them. It's just, you can't do anything about that other than don't put your – if you live in Oklahoma, maybe build an underground house. If you don't live in a place where there's a lot of earthquakes, because there's really nothing you can do to fix that problem. It's the same concept with this. If you moved an island like that, because it's a floating island, it's mobile. There's literally people with islands like that that either have a sail on it or that have a motor, like a motorboat on the back of it, and you can drive it. You can move it with the wind or with the engine if you want to use gasoline. You can move it wherever you want to. And so you can move it to the equator and anchor it there, and then there's not going to be any storms, perfect weather year-round. Now you're going to be able to grow even more food than you already were able to grow with a back-to-eating garden, because Paul Gauchy invented the back-to-eating garden method in Swim, Washington, where it's a winter hell land half the year. So imagine what he could do on the equator with that same knowledge and technology he's invented with the back-to-eating gardening method. If he was on the equator on a freaking mobile floating island, there's no winter. There's no cold days, and there's plenty of rain to self-water, because there's more rain on the equator than there is where he's at in Swim, Washington, and he doesn't ever have to water his plants as it is. So you could do something like what Richard Soa did, but in a more neater – because he was just a homeless guy doing something for free with what he had. But you could literally save up and actually buy and design actual cost-efficient ways of doing this that looks neater, looks prettier, looks better, looks more like actual land floating in the middle of the ocean. He didn't even invent that idea, by the way, Richard Stoa. He did. I found out about it the same way he did. I actually found out about it because I know about world history, and then I was researching if anybody's done it in a modern way, and that's how I found him. But he found out about it the same way I did.
Are you familiar with Earthships?
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't have put an Earthship
on it. Yeah, it sounds like basically it's taking the Earthship concept and transferring it to water.
And then making it a ship, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Actual sea ship. Yeah, because that's why they call Earthships, is because ships have to kind of be somewhat self-sustaining, because they're back in the old days before we had metal boats that could travel across the ocean in a couple of days. They would literally leave one country and not see their family again for 30 years just to make the round trip to and from where they were going. And they had to have a self-sustaining kind of system on that ship, because they couldn't always just reload food and reload this. They had to have a way to dispose of their human waste in a healthy way that didn't cause diseases. They had to have some food that could be grown. They had to do certain things for longer-term trips, and that's why they call an Earthship, because it's like a ship. It's a house that has to be prepared for the unknown, and it's growing its own food, and it's making its own water, and it's disposing of its own waste. And you could do that with an island. With a whole island, you could do that. Yeah, exactly. And He learned that the same way I did, because I study world history, and so did Richard Soa, apparently. And there's people in Peru on it's a funny name. The lake is called Lake Titicaca. Everybody laughs when you say that. It's Peruvian people, the Uru people, live on Lake Titicaca. And these people were facing tyranny from, I believe it was the Incans. Might have been the Aztecs. I don't remember off the top of my head. It was either the Incans or the Aztecs. They were facing tyranny from that people group. That people group was conquering them and taxing them and not providing them any benefit to the taxes they were paying. They were just basically being American government in the past.
Mm-hmm.
A primitive version of our government, just tyranny. And these people were not combative people. They weren't trying to have no Peruvian version of 1776. They just wanted to be left alone. They didn't want to become warriors or Spartans or something. So they said, well, we're not fighters. We're not warriors. We're not good at fighting. This is what we can do. They have a special kind of reed that grows there. It's just like our grass here, except it has a root that is very much like, almost like cork, or almost like foam, almost like marine flotation foam. Like, it floats. And so they would dig this up and cut it into because it's a root, it's not a perfect shape, and they would cut it into square shapes and tie it together and put it on the edge of their shoreline, and then they would pull up the grass that they pulled up to get the roots from out from under. That's tall grass, like 6 foot, 8 foot tall grass, because it's wild grass that's not being mowed. They would lay that down sideways, and when they lay that down sideways, they made a ground with it, just like when Richard Soa put soil on his. And just like when I tell you to back the Eden Garden, you lay down the wood chips and it turns into compost, so does that grass. So they lay it down sideways to create a base, and they layer it really high, and it starts rotting really quickly from the heat of composting and turning into soil. But the top layer stays hard and grass, and that's their walking surface, just like wood chips in a wood chip garden. Stay wood chips on the top, but they turn into compost underneath. And so these people built their own mobile floating islands and built their houses on them. And then when the Incans or the Aztecs, I think it was the Incans though, whenever that people group would come to harvest human sacrifices of their children from them, and to harvest taxes of their food and of whatever they had that they wanted, they'd come to collect. Instead of fighting them or instead of giving them what they want, they just started unanchoring their islands and letting them float. They didn't even put a sail on it, or they didn't have engines back then. This was thousands of years ago. They still do it to this day, though. But they didn't even put engines on them. They didn't put a sail on them. They just unanchored them, and just by natural process, when they would see the people coming miles away, they would unanchor it, and the wind would just naturally blow it, even without a sail, far enough away that those people couldn't mess with them. And so they escaped tyranny, and they escaped taxation by doing that. And they still do it to this day. And now the modern government that controls the bay in this time and day and age, obviously that wouldn't stop them from getting their taxes. We have electric boats and stuff now. They would just send their version of the Coast Guard out there to collect taxes if they wanted to. But they kind of give these people like a grandfathered in pass, because these people bring them in so much tourism to see this that they make money off of people that are coming there just to see these islands. And so they don't want to discourage the people from continuing to build them. So they don't tax them. So these people escape taxes even to this day by building their mobile floating islands. The only problem with theirs is that it's all built out of all organic materials. So those roots eventually rot. and the ground eventually rots away. And they don't plant grass on it, so the ground doesn't keep replacing itself, and they don't have something that doesn't that floats but doesn't rot, so the islands will eventually, after 25 to 30 years, they'll start to sink, and they have to rebuild them over and over and over again.
We're in way overtime, so we're going to not cut it short because we're in overtime. Look, thanks. We're going to have you back soon. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day. I don't want Blog Talk to kick us off for Broadway.
Thank you.